consumers a serious direction. And it indicates that it's very important for us not to misunderstand what people are saying. My grandson the other day told me, after his mother had had a scare with security issues and had kind of bumped them all up, that his mother had called, she got a strange phone call and called up the airport. I thought, my God, what is he getting into his head being grandson of an MP now, calling up the airport? I said, exactly what did you say? What did your mother say? She said, well, she told Mark she's calling out the flying squad. I thought, now you see, it's very easy to misunderstand what people are saying, whether you're a child or an adult. We don't have, we have two apologies. Honorable Sabelli, do you have any? Oh yes, the medical apology from Honorable Vandenberger. And of course another medical apology from the Honorable Oriani Ambrosini. And the fact of the matter is he should never have been in the house yesterday. And I did advise him of that. He's not at all well. But be that as it may, he is very ill actually. Then members on the adoption of the agenda, I have asked the minister to address a couple of issues here other than what is before us. But it is related to the NDC. The Honourable James, in a communication to me, did indicate, and in fact I have made them available to you, just reminded me of some media reports on the Consumer Commission, etc., to get this house in order. Well, of course, we've been asking for that for some time in a number of different ways on good government. So I have asked the minister to address that just prior to the SEZ. So on that basis, can we move with that amendment the adoption of the agenda? Thank you, Honourable Mabasa, seconded by Honourable Mabasa. And immediately then, for this long time, we are fairly much on time. So Minister, it will be straight over to you, Dr. Rob Davies. And I should just say welcome to the DG and the entire top team that you've brought here once again. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Chairperson, on the National Consumer Commission, I'm just going to make a brief comment on the Public Protector's report, which was issued a few days ago, as well as on the question of the appointment of the new commissioner, which we are obliged to consult the relevant portfolio committee on, and this is the relevant portfolio committee. So let me say that the report of the Public Protector, basically what it said was it said that there was remedial action required of us, and it said that the minister, I'm reading from it, short part of it, the minister must take urgent steps to ensure that there is a clear definition of the relationship between the DG, Director General, and the Commissioner, as well as the Minister's role. The Commissioner's role as accounting authority is clarified, and the HR management process will be clarified. The NCC should continue its ongoing process of tightening its financial accounting and supply chain management processes. And then it says the Public Protector will require from the Minister an implementation plan on the manner in which the remedial action referred to in paragraph 11 above, which I just read, will be implemented within 30 days of the date of this report, and a progress report on the implementation of the remedial action referred to in paragraph 11 above within 60 days of the date of the report. The Public Protector will monitor the progress made in this regard over regular intervals. Let me just say we had cited this report before it was released. We will comply absolutely to the letter with those recommendations. And in particular, if there is another incident in one of our entities where staff members transfer from the department, want to return to the department, we will certainly handle it in a way differently to the way it was handled in this particular case. I would, though, that's the only comment I want to make on this report, except one other thing. I think it's worth noting that the report is called There Are No Heroes. It does say in paragraph 10.613 of the report, it says, and I quote, the procurement of officers is the subject of a different public protective investigation into various alleged governance and administrative irregularities. And I want to say that with regards to that, when the former commissioner left office, I asked for a status report, an investigation status report, That report is pretty much completed, and within a few weeks at the most, we will be sharing that report with the hurricane protector in terms of that particular paragraph. So I think that's the comp I want to make on that. And then to say, on the other side of it, well, that's just to say in advance that I think that the questions of the kind of quality character that we need of the Commission, I think are related to the strategic direction that the Commissioner or the candidate would put in place for the operation of the NCC. And I think that we have seen that the, under the stewardship of the Acting Commissioner, there has been focus on treating compliance orders not as a first port of call, but as a last port of call, on trying to solve consumer problems at source, trying to build partnerships with other entities, this, I believe, is the kind of strategic direction which will make the Consumer Commission more relevant and more effective as a tool of supporting consumer protection in the country. The indication that we've sent to you under Section 87.2 of the Act, which says that the Minister must consult the relevant parliamentary committee before making an appointment. Just want to say that we had an interview panel which included the Minister of Public Service and Administration, we interviewed four candidates for the post, and the information that we're conveying to you is that the proposal that I want to consult you with you on is that we appoint the Acting Commissioner, Mr. Ibrahim Mohammed, as the National Consumer Commissioner. That is the indication to the portfolio committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Minister. I think it would be constructive for us now just to get members' comments or questions on the matter. Honourable James, followed by Honourable McIntosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to say, first of all, that we admire the fact that the Minister has dealt with this question of responding to the recommendation of the Public Protector's Report titled "There Are No Heroes." With such speed and with such decisiveness. I think that is to be admired, and I'd like to thank him for doing that so very quickly. The fact is that consumer protection is a important public function of that commission. It is an entity that falls under DTI, and we've seen 2 years, up to 2 years of difficulties around protecting the consumer because the institution never settled down. It is our view that it's an underfunded body from its kind, given its mandate, and so we look forward to the proper functioning of the MCC looking into the future.
Honourable James, Honourable McIntosh.
Madam Chair, I concur with Honourable James. I think the department in particular has handled it pretty well. I think I have done about all the statement, but I also read this newspaper report. And I generally agree with the Director General, but I must say I completely agree with his statement there. We were in this portfolio committee having the NCC, and you, Madam Chair, the responsible chair lady, brought the NCC. And it was quite clear the department was extremely twitchy and uncomfortable with what was going on. And I commend them for acting, I think, in this matter. Madam Chair, I do think there's one other thing that should come up. Because in our society at the moment, and in this department, we are dealing with bills, dealing with racial content. And I think we need to, for the sake of black women in particular, to say, was this commissioner appointed simply because she was black and female, and was that the major comment? Because I believe when somebody comes into a position and she can't handle it, it's not a credit to black women in general and the competence of them. And I think we need to put that, let's forget about it, but I think we should have that in the back of our mind, that we must appoint on merit, and secondly, then look for affirmation and empowerment. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable McIntosh. Honourable Adebe.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'd like to concur with my honourable colleague, Dr. James, that we welcome the speedy response of the Minister in regard to the report of the public protector, which the colleague specifically mentions that there were no heroes in this saga. But, you know, when I was looking at the outcome of the public protector, I remember one ANC steward, Commandant Mutali, who was in Robben Island with the likes of Governor Mbeki, Mandela, Sisulu, who once said that if, as a comrade, you are not going to make any mistake, we then will know that you are doing nothing. They are doing nothing. They rather live with the people who make mistakes in trying to transform the past. So I think the saga which occurred there, it was the issue of the people trying to do what they are supposed to be, what they are doing all the way. And then really, I still maintain, I respect what the DC did. I respect the work which was done by the National Commissioner, Kuduma Commissioner. She was not appointed because she was a black female. She was qualified as why her appointment was ratified by the committee, because she had the relevant qualification to do the job. But we know that as we do our work, sometimes we can be overwhelmed by the situation we didn't anticipate. So we respect all of them and what they have done for our country, and they have made us proud. But I think that this saga is the issue of the learning curve for all of us, that really, as we establish new institutions, we must never have an unplanned type of intervention. We must always bring them closer to us so that we nurture them until they are strong and viable. So really, what I appreciate most, Chairperson, is the acceptance of the department of the recommendation of the public protector report. That was very important. So it means that the chaplain institution is not being undermined by the department. That one must be highly recommended. And then, Chairperson, on the issue of the appointment, or on the other issue, we raised again, as we raised it during the public hearings of the strategic plan of the NCC plan department. We said that the NCC is underfunded. I concur with my colleague, Honorable Chair, that it is still underfunded. I think that the minister must put all the stops possible, do anything possible to ensure that the organogram of that structure goes beyond the digital period as it is now. But as we know, Mr. Alexander, really something is being done, they'll be taking it to the treasury. We know that they do their best. Honorable regards, really appreciate the department and the ministry. Chairperson, on the issue of the appointment of the new commissioner, I think that also the panel which was dealing with the appointment has done a good job, because it has appointed someone who got an inside information of what is happening inside the commission, the former deputy commissioner. And then what is also important, you look at the credentials of Mr. Mohammed. It's very important. This person has worked with a striker stalwart like Dr. Omar, Dr. Bayer Nodier, the distinguished and the constitutional court judge, Arthur Hickerson, the distinguished former MP of this parliament, Dr. Sikweye, Dr. Brigadeba. When you can look at the quality of these people he had worked with, you know that he was working with the people who really fought apartheid, who really ensured that the rights of the people who were transported to South Africa were protected. So we know that as he's going to execute his duties, he'll ensure that the downtrodden consumers of South Africa are going to be protected. That one comes in, Chairperson, has got evidence of the systems which they have put in place since he has assumed power as an elected commissioner. One thing which I really commended for the President is their ability to engage the industry. That one is very important, so that the industry has the buy-in to this institution, the ability to delegate some work to the provinces, so that all the forces which deal with consumer affairs become a cohesive force. So I think that this one is a proper appointment. This committee has got no other option except to support that appointment.
Thank you very much, Honourable Kadebe. Honourable Mabasa.
Thank you very much, Colleague Chair. Consumer issues are also transformative issues in our developing South Africa. But the point that, because colleague Adebe has already covered a number of points, but the point that I want to emphasize is that the minister had not made a mistake when he appointed the former Ms. Clara. It was not an affirmative action case. She, in her own right, is a highly qualified person, a former EG for that matter. And then indeed, because if we go with this trend, we may find ourselves falling short of effective transformation in as far as it must favor women and in as far as it must favor blacks in the broader sense. And so I thought it important to emphasize, because transformation still has to be undertaken. And we must not we mustn't confuse the department, and we must also not work against the minister when he effects appointments that speak to transformation. But there is no way in which people are like appointed merely on the basis of gender or merely on the basis of color. It's never like that. It's all qualifications. On ability, but that does not disregard gender and the formerly oppressed people.
Yes, I think we had broad inputs from everyone here. We've covered a variety of areas. Suffice to say that, yes, indeed, we did engage at length with the NCC, primarily because, in the Whip's, Honourable Debbie's own words at the beginning, we must monitor the new baby on the block, as it were. And therefore we were conscious of, you know, regular monitoring. And that is why we were able, certainly, to pick up what I call some of the financial management issues. Now, of course, this in no way, it casts a negative reflection on anyone's qualifications. The most highly qualified of people do, make these errors of judgment in that area. So certainly we want to welcome the position adopted by the department in doing what the committee requested, speedily addressing those issues. But I must also concur that at the time, the person who was appointed, Commissioner Moshlali, that was indeed qualified for the position. So we shouldn't go along the route of was she qualified in affirmative action. It was a qualified person. That's not what is a debate here at all. And I hasten to add that. But I do want to thank the Minister for his transparent approach to the matter and ask him to conclude on this issue. But just before you do that, I'd just say to members, you've got the full summary of the CV, the shortened one, and then the full one here. And that does show a long history of association in this area per se. Honourable Minister?
Well, thank you very much, and I think thanks for the comments. I don't think there's a need to respond to many of them, just to simply say that the appointment of former Commissioner Ms. Mokhlali was the result of the fact that she parted company with the Department of Communication, where she was the Director General, and the settlement was that she should be appointed to a similar position, and she looked through the possible options and she went for this one. And then we have to engage on that basis. That's how she came in. She was not somebody who was just appointed because they were not qualified. She's a lawyer. She's been a DG. She was qualified. There was a debate about the independence of the body. And, of course, I think that we respected the fact that a body like this should act without fear or favor. We never sought to tell them what decisions they should be taking. But there was a strategic line that he took. That strategic line was quite a number of compliance orders were sought. many of which, or most of which, were then subsequently overturned by the National Consumer Tribunal and something else. And then a lot of backlogs because, you know, the Commission deals with a lot of individual consumer complaints. My car was not, you know, treated in the right way when I was in the garage or whatever, that sort of thing. And so, again, I would say that I concur with what Honourable Khalevi said. I think that the current strategic direction commissioner, the current acting commissioner, the one that we want to appoint, is going where you solve complaints lower down, you build partnerships, you actually also build partnerships with provinces, which are also involved in this, and you deal with complaints generically. I think that seems to me to be a direction that potentially has more possibility of success than the other direction. I think that's a point I would make in that regard. We see, let me just stress on my side, that we see consumer protection as very fundamental. There were points made at one stage or other that because we are supporting manufacturing development, we are somehow or other not interested in consumer protection. I want to say that's not true. But also we see a lot of symbiosis between supporting local manufacturing and being able to comply with the Consumer Protection Act. So we think of something like the Consumer Protection Act linked with something like the Workers and National Regulator Compulsory Specification can create major space for South African companies to position themselves around producers of quality goods and services and produce and be competitive against non-compliant imported products. So I think that we do think that the work of the Consumer Commission is important, does need to be strengthened. On the question that was raised of the body being underfunded, well, let me just say that it's never been a choice of ours, neither now nor in the past. It's never been that we have gone to Treasury and said, don't give them any money. It's never been like that. There is a process of budget choices in this country. I think that, of course, you all know as members of Parliament that you have powers in relation to the budget now. You can also make your own voice heard on this particular matter. I've been saying to the Commission that what we need to see is the development of a credible track record, and then we can use that as the basis to ask for more funding from Treasury. But you know, the way it works is that you submit a budget application. I do sit on the Minister's Committee of the Budget, but the convention there is you don't fight the corner. So I'm sitting there arguing for these things. You have to understand that or that. So that's the process, that's how it works, and I think that looking for continuous improvement in the performance of the National Consumer Commission, that will be what we will be seeking in terms of performance agreements from the Commissioner, that will be what we will be monitoring, and I think that will also be the basis on which we'll be able to argue for additional budgetary support later on. But maybe there are also partnerships that can be built with private sector players around some of these matters, and I think that's what some of the work that's been done is all about. So let me leave it in this. If Mr. Ninji wants to add anything? Okay. I think he's been at the word go suitably and launched.
Thank you very much, Minister. And I just want to also note that among the members dealing with the NCC in this area, of course, we actually have the DDG here, and that is Mr. Tumela Chifupa. Of course, we've mentioned the DG already, but we also have a few others who are here, and I don't know if I'm correct. I see the others are from BHP Billiton, NCC. That would appear to be the delegation you brought for NCC, is that right? Well, the DTI. You see, this is what I'm saying, that it's really not the process, per se, because that's why I didn't acknowledge you to begin with, Mr. Fupa. But what the person we should acknowledge is the advocate Johannes Strydom from DTI, and also the advocate Charmaine van der Merwe from the Parliamentary Legal Office over there. And thank you very much, Minister, for a short notice addressing this issue. I see you wanted to have the last word, Honourable James. Thank you.
My apologies, Chair. I simply failed to point out that we support the appointment of Mr. Ibrahim Muhammad. I didn't say anything about that, but just to say from our side, we do that.
Right, so, esteemed Minister, you have the full support. I'm sure Cope would also agree, is that right?
That's what I wanted to say. I also just want to say one thing. Somebody said there were no heroes, I think it was the thing wrong. I actually think there has been a hero, and that's the Director General and his staff.
Right, okay. You're not sending your CV to DTI, are you? But thank you on a serious note, and I know Honourable McIntosh's engagement has always been very robust, so that you should accept that as it is.
I said he was suitably modest, now he's been suitably applauded, I think.
Honourable Sajebi, the ANC?
I said that it was very clear. I didn't give them welcome for why.
I heard the motivation, yes. Thank you very much. So, members, we then move speedily on one of the Fridays that is moving according to plan, it seems. 9:30, briefing on the SEZ. And that is a time when we would want to welcome the DDG, Chifupa, on the matter. But at the same time, ask the Minister. You will recall, Minister, we've had an informal briefing at some point in time on the matter. So I'm sure this is a continuation. Thank you very much.
Thanks. I'm going to say very much. The presentation will be given by the DG and the team. Essentially, what's before the committee now is the Special Economic Zones Bill. I think last time we talked about the matter, we said that simultaneously with the bill, we are doing some of the work that can be the product of this bill when the bill is processed and passed, and that is to identify potential special economic zones in the country. We have been working with the provinces. We have identified 10 potential projects which are going into feasibility study process now. This has been worked on with the provincial government, the partnership. At least one of the projects of the province has been identified in this regard. The only other point I really want to make is you'll see a slide later on of the value of investments in the existing industrial development zone. And it does show, it does show growth over time. So I wanted to just give one example, which is the East London Industrial Development Zone. In 2009, that industrial development zone was hosting investments with a total value of 600 billion rand. And if you look at the graph that is going to come later on, you'll see it's now hosting investments with a value of 4 billion rand. And there's been a similar growth in Kuba. So I think that these IDZs are beginning to gain some traction. I think there's a number of factors that are responsible for that, including the way in which they are managed and the way in which they are promoted and the messages that have been sent to investors, both domestic and foreign, important as strategic choices and developments that are taking place. So the industrial development zones will continue to be one of the elements of the SEZ, and as I'm sure members will know, we are very close to finalising a designation of the latest one, which will be the Saldana IDZ. So I think the presentation will come from the team. So that's all from me. Thanks.
Thank you
very much, DG, Mr. October.
Thank you. I think Melissa has made the comment that we have been through extensive meetings. We've been through an extensive period of consultation, both NEDSAC and the public consultation process, so I will skip those comments and get straight into the matter. Just by way of background, as the Minister indicated that we made an assessment, a strategic review of the performance of the IDZ, and I think at that point it was realized that I think they were performing modestly, and also that there was definitely room for improvement. But the main issue that came out of that assessment was there wasn't a national regulatory framework to govern our IDZs, and that's why we needed to to develop a more robust legislation on that matter. Also, clearly IDZs were came into being prior to both the National Development Plan, the New Growth Path, and the National Industrial Policy Framework. So it was really necessary for us to align this tool of industrial development with our National Industrial Policy Action Plan. So that was the genesis of the work on bringing the bill. I think, as I said, economically, as part of our overall strategy, we see SEZ as a useful tool both to stimulate domestic and regional demand, but most importantly to also locate our industry within global supply chains, and really, as I indicated, to expand, as one of the tools to expand our industrial base to large other parts of the country, so that we don't just have a concentration in the major metropoles. We then, as I said, we went through the drafting process, and thereafter, after public consultation, we then went into the NEDLAC consultation. I can just emphasize, NEDLAC required extra time, and that is why there is such a gap between our initial briefing to the portfolio committee and the current presentation. But I could say that this was a very useful process because we managed to get major area of agreement between business, community and labor on this piece of legislation. There's also been then some improvements on it. I think we list there that in general we've reached agreement on especially how to define SEZ. As we know, there was lots of debate about the different models of SEZ, as you know, export processing zones, used as cheap labor areas or weak forms of industrialization, and I think we agreed on a model which will be, which is agreed by all parties. We also agreed on the need for dedicated incentives and for proper regulated environment for that. So I think there was broad consultation on most of the bill by business and labor. I'll just quickly highlight some of the issues that where there was disagreement on it, and then give the DTI's view. After the minister had a consultation, we managed to find a breakthrough on all those areas of disagreements. Firstly, it's about the composition of the SEZ board, and really there was a proposal from Labour, especially that the parties in NEDLAC be represented or have nominate people from those constituents onto the board as well. Our view, and I think which has been accepted, was that we should allow for constituencies, for business, labour and communities to have representatives on the board, but that they meet the qualification criteria with regard to experience and knowledge of in this area. So that is how we've resolved that one. The other issue which was debated, as you know, we will see later on, that we allow municipalities or provinces or national to propose the establishment of a SEZ. And there was a feeling from business that maybe municipalities are not capacitated enough or it's not their core business, that they should be excluded from this provision of being able to do that. Our view after much discussion is that we obviously made a point that there are many municipalities who are very capable of being able to do, for example, as in London, in Port Elizabeth and so on. We've seen that they've been able to manage IDZ and so on. So our proposal is that because there is a rigorous process for evaluation and for an application process, we should keep or allow municipalities to be able to propose IDZs or SEZs. Then the other issue of debate was about the ownership of SEZs. Firstly, there was a view from some sections of business that we have privately operated SEZs and so on. I think the consensus view, which was accepted from the department, was that we should go the triple P route, public-private partnerships with regard to, as well as also able to run IDZs, and as I said, that was accepted after a discussion. Then again, as I said, from Labour's view, it's again the opposite, that we shouldn't allow these triple P's because they sort of just disguise form of private ownership. I think we emphasize that it's joint ownership by a collaborative relationship between public and private sector to run IGZ. So that's how we dealt with the ownership issue, and that's our proposals in that regard. The other issue is just about the process of consultation on the regulations and on guidelines. There was a view that we must go back every time the minister issues guidelines, he needs to go back to NEDLAC and so on. I think we've resolved the issue on the basis that we've explained that regulations in any case are put out for public comment. There is always a rigorous process of consultation by the department and by the minister when he does issue that regulation. And so that process is efficient, and we don't need to go back with each and every guideline that we issue. Then I'll just very briefly also just give, I think the minister touched on the current sort of progress with IDZs, and I think it's really in the past 2 years where we've seen a pickup in investor interest in IDZs. And there you can see the number of investors in the Kuka and London. If I say out of the four IDZs, there's three that are functional. That is basically the Kuka is London and Richards Bay, and the Johannesburg International Airport is still not fully operational yet. So that shows the progress of it, and as Minister indicated, we are gaining traction with regard to attracting some very strategic investors like the Johnson Control Instruments in London and the First Automotive Works doing trucks and cars in Kuka. This again just gives some of the figures mentioned already. The other one, just on the current progress, the matter which is currently before is the Saldana IDZ, and just a quick update on that. The minister issued it for entering into a public consultation process in Saldana in January. We've gone through the public consultation process that's completed, and in general there is strong support for an IDZ in Saldana. Currently, they are just busy with trying to finalize the land that will be declared as an IDZ, that is land from the IDC and from the TNPA, and that matter is just currently, there is a request that the minister assists with that process, and then shortly it will be, a decision will be made on this IDZ. Let's just emphasize the feasibility study for this IDZ shows a very, very positive potential, especially as a hub for the oil and gas industry, and that would be the anchor industry for this IDZ. That's just the Kuka and the Zlatan one. If we turn to the bill, as I said, I'm going to go through it quite quickly because I understand that the committee will interrogate the bill in detail as it usually does with, so as I indicated, the key purpose of the bill is really to set up an overall regulatory framework for the designation, promotion, and development and the operations of the special economic zone. Purpose is to establish a advisory board which will advise the minister on applications and on strategy for the special economic zone. Also, the bill will allow the minister, in consultation with the Minister of Finance, to establish a special economic zone fund. I think this is the most important provision in the bill because currently applications for funding is done through the MTF process and it's on an ad hoc basis. And in this way, if we have a dedicated, it would be much better long-term planning if we have a dedicated fund to fund infrastructure and so forth. And of course, to regulate the licensing process. We then also define exactly what we mean by the special economic zone. And just to mention, it will be much broader than just the current IDZs. The current IDZs must be located near an international port or airport. But we think there's a number of different models that can be developed because the key principle is just it's a tool for industrialization. Also, the Act deals with the development of a policy and strategy, and then also it's to develop SEZ-specific incentive regime. There's a The problem up until now is that we've had there was nothing special about the special economic zones because they didn't have dedicated incentives. But I think as already in the Minister of Finance's budget vote, we started to move in the direction of getting incentives. But this will provide the legal framework for that. Similarly, this slide just lays out in detail what the purposes are for special economic zones. And as I indicated, one big element of it is to spread the, let's say, regional development to less developed parts of the country. That must be special emphasis must be given to diversifying our industrial base. Then again, the bill deals in terms of Section 5, Section 6 deals with the minister setting clear policy direction for IDZs, and then also it says that there will be a strategy that must be developed in consultation with the board. Then Section 7 deals with the board itself, the constitution of the board, the number of members, and how, what the requirements are for membership of the advisory board. Let me just say that it is envisaged that the big utilities, Eskom, Transnet, who are obviously critical for the functioning of IDZs, will be represented on this board, so that you have coordination between different different institutions, so that, as I said, we have uniformity. Section 11 deals with the functions of the board, and as I said, the main function is of an advisory nature. As I said before, it is promulgated, there are certain criteria that must be met in terms of economic viability, proper consultation processes and so forth, and they will then advise the minister before he makes a decision. They will also look at, applications and whether the operators meet the criteria to be able to effectively operate a zone. This again just sets out in Section 11 all the powers and functions of the board. With regard to the secretariat of the board, again, as per our discussions on other matters, we said that the secretariat will be located within the department to service and to serve the secretariat for the board, so that's Section 17, where we set out that function. Section 20, again, I think is the most important provision here. It says that the minister, with the concurrence of the Minister of Finance, may establish a SEZ fund to support the promotion and development of the city. As I said, the team led by Tumelo Chipuga is already working with Treasury on the modalities of such a fund, but that's dealt with in Section 20. Then also Section 21 deals with the incentives I referred to earlier, which is just to put in place proper support measures specifically for companies that locate within the NZ. Section 22 again is the application for designation. As I indicated, it sets out which organs of state and bodies can apply for the designation of SEZ. As I said, it will be both a national, province, municipality, public entities, but also public-private partnerships can apply for designation. And then, as I said, it also set out in some detail the process that must be followed and what must be contained in the application process. So that's Section 22. Again, that lays out the qualification criteria for applicants, they have sufficient financial resources, expertise, and so on. And again, we're saying that applications must be backed up by evidence-based studies, and feasibility studies must be conducted before a SEZ can be designated. This also, Decision 23 also just deals with what exactly, as I said, must be a defined geographic area. The SEZ operator must be able to have access and control of the land under its jurisdiction. Then we are adopting a model which allows a variety of different types of zones.
and it sets out in section 23 the different kinds we have. So for example, you can have the free port model, the free trade zone, the IBZ model which I mentioned earlier, and then also sector specific ones. As I said, you will see later there are some studies which will be certain SEZs will focus on, for example, renewable energy or beneficiation and so on. It will be sector specific SEZs. And so that's laid out in section 23. It spells out all the guidelines and all the different categories of SEZs. Section 24, again, is the important one which has been lacking in the old legislation, which is really proper governance and oversight and management of the SEZs. So section 24 lays out in detail the criteria and the governance arrangements with regard to licensees and the regulations that needs to be complied with, the PMMA, the municipal regulations, treasury regulations, etc. So section 24 deals with that. Section 25 deals with, as I mentioned earlier, the minister will develop a strategic plan for SEZs, and this also lays out that every SEZ must have a strategic plan which will be reviewed by the minister. They must also develop for 3 years business and financial plans for the operation of the SEZ. Section 26 sets out that requirement. Section 28 deals with a question where if a SEZ becomes dysfunctional or doesn't perform in terms of its license requirement, it allows the power for the minister, after consultation with the board, to be able to take over the administration of an SEZ. I think this is a standard requirement in legislation of this nature. Section 29 also deals with under what circumstances. As you can see, it's not arbitrary, this lays out the criteria when the minister may suspend or withdraw a designation. Section 29 deals with that matter. Section 30 then deals with the function powers of the SEZ operator, and then also the conditions under which the minister will license or permit, issue a permit for operators. Section 31, as I said, also deals with the operator permit that will be issued. Section 32 lays out the requirements for the application process, and again, as it says, it must be a company registered in South Africa. It says they must have sufficient capital, expertise, and able to operate, and that is set out in 32. Section 34 deals with the functions of the SEZ operator in some detail. And that's, I will not go through each one. Section 35 again deals with the withdrawal of a permit if an operator does not perform its function as per required at section 35, 36 as well. And then, yes, this is the important one. Section 38 deals with transitional provisions. As we know, we have the current IDZs operating, and then also until the new act comes into operation, it allows for a transitional period. So, for example, it will allow for the Raldana IDZ to be issued under the current regulations, and then once the new act comes into operation, it will be able to make a smooth transition into the new regime. So that's Section 38, is transitional provisions. As I said, to ensure efficient functioning, Minister may from time to time issue guidelines on how what's the best models for operating IDZs. And then, of course, the Minister must issue regulations, and Section 40 sets out the regulations around that. As I indicated, there's been a very extensive process of consultation, both with the public and NEDLAC process and with the Portfolio Committee. We have submitted it to the state law advisors. They've confirmed that it is constitutional and that meets the requirements. So that process has been completed as well. We just set out the bodies we consulted, right from especially the ESCOM, National Planning Commission, DBSA, all the government departments, especially SARS, which will
operate the customs controlled area. So there's been extensive engagement with SARS and of course with National Treasury on the SEZ fund and on the incentives. So the next stage is, as I said, is to is the National Assembly to do consideration and then to go to the NCOP because in terms of say, Section 76 of that. And then we also are engaged already in trying to look at doing draft regulations which will be issued once the bill comes into effect. Just as the Minister indicated, we simultaneously, while we're working on the legislation, we are also actively working on these new potential zones. After extensive engagement with provinces, we've identified for studies the following SEZ, and these studies are underway, but just to mention three ones which is really showing some potential already. The one is the Upington one, which will deal with solar energy. The other one is the Dubai Trade Port. During the BRICS meeting, there was interest given by some of the Indian companies to locate in that area. And then finally, there is one on platinum beneficiation. So as I said, those studies are now are currently underway, and we hope in the next, let's say, 6 months. The Minister and Minmec have given us 6 months to complete these studies and then to make proposals on formalizing these SEZ, and hopefully the new bill will be in place. We also engaged in the extensive capacity building program with the provinces to be able for people to operate and manage these special economic zones. I think that, Madam Chair, is both the context and some of the introduction of some of the amendments.
Thank you very much, DG. Now, members, we've heard that some of us have had an initial briefing, as I said. So it's open to you. Comment, raise your questions now. Thank you. Honourable McIntosh, Honourable Kadevi, Honourable Kobasa, Honourable Mabasa.
Madam Chair, obviously the committee will chew the fat on this bill, but I certainly think it's in good time for us as South Africans. I do believe we should be aware that there's a lot of competition out there, including in the rest of Africa. I understand as soon as the Kenyan politics and elections calmed down, Samsung and Honda announced that they were putting factories into Kenya. And I gather this is increasing happening in Ethiopia, and some people are saying that Nigeria is the new India of Africa. So I don't think it's just the Asians that will be the low-cost labor manufacturing centers. And of course, we know that they do have a competitive edge north of us because they don't have one of our favorite organizations called COSATU on the go in those countries. But I do think we must understand that our competition isn't just from Asia, Europe, and America. It's actually from our own very own continent in the next 10 years. So the SEZ bill is most helpful. Madam Chair, I want to just mention, and we're going to have a presentation just now, following on this one, from Richards Bay, which is where the billiton aluminium smelter is. But in terms of planning and growth, Richards Bay globally is a fine example of how a government has established from virtually nothing a new city, a new industrial area, and a new port, because that is the critical thing of port. And I'm really disappointed to see how little money, IDZ money, goes to Richards Bay. Now, as I said, I don't know whether it was political, or because the ANC didn't want to send money to an IFP-controlled province at that stage, but I really don't think it's in the national interest for us to neglect Richards Bay. It's a wonderful infrastructure. Secondly, talking as a KwaZulu person, Madam Chair, in terms of funding for SEZ, if you go back 25 years, there was the most amazing, thorough and excellent study on the Tugela Basin. It was done by the Town and Regional Planning Commission under a man called Simon Smith, and it was an incredibly good study. And I think, really, the department or the KwaZulu government should pull that out of the archive. It's not only in the archive, probably, but dust it off, of course, nothing digital or electronic, as good as we get. But a very, very important study to develop areas like Greytown and Pine Cloud, Chiquilla Ferry, Ladysmith, and so on. So I think that please bear that in mind. And finally, I just want to say what comes through all the time is the huge need we are going to have in this country for skills, Madam Chair. It's so important for us to, I mean the National Development Plan stresses it. We are going to need every single skill we possibly can get. And I know Honourable Khadebe always beats the drum, education, education, education. We need quality education for all our people. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable McIntosh, Honourable Kodansa.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want two very brief clarity. On page 17 and page 18, the third bullet on the second slide, section 22, the section 22 slide, where it says that an applicant must indicate the extent of ownership or control of the land. Supposing that somebody wants to establish an IT there in a rural area, and to a large extent, rural areas are communal land, generally controlled by traditional leadership. But some of that land might be government-owned land. How do you then determine ownership or control of that piece of land? That's the clarity I seek. The second one on page 18, the free port of free trade zone, particularly the free port, I don't understand what is meant by free port. My understanding of a port largely is that it is owned by government. I'm not aware of a port that is privately owned, unless there is there. So I want to understand what is meant by a free port or a free trade zone.
Thanks.
Thank you very much, colleague, and a warm welcome to this presentation for various reasons. One of the reasons is that if we succeed exceptionally well with this challenge, it also does point to a typical solution to development challenges. So that we may come to a stage where we see special economic zones developing in a bigger number all over the country. So that's why it's so critical that these that are being planned succeed. And then the second is to say it would be good if universities and technicons nearest to this SEZ can relate to them right from inception, so that we have our institutions, trained institutions, identifying relevance and relationship, because that also assists the universities and technicons themselves in terms of practical work, so that the studies become more relevant to what is their needs on the ground. Then the one but last point is where is the challenge to partner properly with non-municipalities. I did not understand that point where there was an argument. Actually, there is a clarity here where there was an argument that some municipalities have so failed that they cannot come into the game. My question was, assuming they don't come into the game because they have failed, then what constitutes municipalities in as far as municipalities primarily have to provide certain things? But that's one point for clarity. But the other point is to say it is critical that all the three spheres of government move in unison so that the complementarity benefits can accrue to this FCPEN. Thanks, Commissioner.
Thank you very much, Honourable Mabasa. Honourable Hill Lewis.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and for the, thank you to the DGR for the presentation. Two questions that I have. One is about job displacement. There's an extent to which, you know, when you talk about job creation numbers in Kuka and East London, we're not sure whether those are new jobs created or whether those companies have relocated from other parts of the country because of the attractiveness of locating inside an IDV. Is there a plan? Is there some way in which we can address job displacement with regards to SDZs? The second question is around incentives. The bill is largely silent on the issue of incentives except for a very brief section 21, which basically just allows the minister to set incentives. And in fact, it makes reference to the minister or any other, or a minister of any other government department. But it doesn't say anything about premiers or mayors. To what extent are other levels of government who, as you've already made clear, are able to initiate an FDZ, also able to bring something to the table in terms of incentives? And here I'm thinking specifically of electricity charges in the case of local government. And if those local governments are serious about you know, attracting investment and job creation, then they also need to be able to bring something to the table in that regard. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Hill Lewis. Also, a minister, just on some of the points that Honourable Gavasa made, I see you've got some transitional arrangements with respect to IDZs, etc. Now, to me, it would be useful because you do have these 1, 2, 3, 4 taxable categories, as you call them, free trade, free port, free trade, industrial development, or affected development zone. And we are aware already that the IDZs operate under slightly, you know, different, shall I say, a framework, regulatory framework. It would be useful to know, are you building in a transitional phase here, or is there going to be an immediate slap on and conversion? How exactly will that be transpire? The other area as well is, and we must welcome that this does offer the opportunity in an instrument for the creation of jobs and economic development. But I think the Honourable Hildreth has got a point there, exactly what is it, how many will be lost, how many will be gained, etc. But the other point here is the funding aspect. I would hope, seen as this bill is scheduled for this year, that and I just can't recall, that's my problem, the MTEF arrangements, where we may have done some forward funding in this direction, or at least indicative, can I put it that way? Because I would imagine, notwithstanding the PPP approach, that there would be the need for considerable investment from the public sector here. But if you can just give us an idea as to how that will work, thank you.
Okay, I'll take some of the questions and then some of them go to the team. Let me just say on the question of what Honourable McIntosh said about competition, I think that I would start off by saying that I would welcome the fact that we are seeing industrial development on the rest of the African continent. We want to see the African continent grow and develop. The countries you mentioned are all countries that have identified industrialization as critical to their futures. And I think that, you know, for example, our role in the tripartite negotiations is an indication that we see industrialization across the continent as the basis on which we can grow intra-regional trade and also expand our own industrial base. I think that we will not be going for the same kind of industrial sectors. There will be complementarity. South Africa will have to position itself a bit differently to the way some of the others do. But I said in another forum the other day, because I was asked a question, well, what happens if Nigeria overtakes South Africa and becomes has a higher GDP than Africa? Some people say that in 5 or 6 years' time. and I refer to the way my colleague, Deputy Minister Jeremy Cohen, was talking about provinces. I mean, get away from this absolutely cup mentality. If Nigeria grows, develops and industrialized, it would be good for the African continent and ultimately it would be good for South Africa. And in particular with Nigeria, with my colleague, Lisbon Maganga, we are in a lot of deep discussion about how we can cooperate around the circle. There's complementarity as well as competition. But I think it comes to another point that a number of colleagues were mentioning. The way an IEZ or an SEZ becomes competitive is a function of a number of things. I've had the opportunity to go to a special economic zone in one or two other countries. I mean, one that sticks in my mind is in Indonesia, where I think the management, the development of the product, what kind of specific services you offer within the site, that includes the factory buildings being in place, it includes if not the price, but I think the municipal price of electricity is also a critical factor, but the regularity of the supply, all of those kind of things I think are very, very critical to the success of an SEZ, as well as whatever incentive you put in place. If you put incentive in place, the rest is not there, they're not going to really work. So I think that's the way I think we need to look at this. So we want successful, well-functioning operators and managers of SEZ programs with a good concept in place and a good hands-on management. I think if you ask my candidate opinion what Cities London around is, I think this is largely action in this kind of area, that we have, I think, a much more a dynamic management of the SEZ down there, which has managed to gain the confidence of a growing number of investors and actually has managed to diversify outside of its original core, which was the motor industry and motor components manufacturing, which is still its core, but it managed to diversify. As far as Richard Bayer could say, well, you're going to have a meeting and catch people, listen, there's been one very, very important event, and that's the one I want to raise with you. It won't be here when that happens, but that's the electricity which they've got. So that's the issue I raise with you. But I would just want to say that there is another, there was a signature of an agreement of the BRICS with Richard Bayer and a Chinese company around boat building with a potentiality to morph into ship building. I think that's another area of activity for Richard Bayer. Any other points I want to make? A free port doesn't mean a free port means a duty-free port. That's what it means. It doesn't mean that you don't have to pay any port charges or that it's owned by somebody else. A free trade zone is the same thing. What I think you can see is that if you look at the 10 potential SEZs, and I think we stress potential, that has to go through feasibility study, there's plenty to go through the process, outline and build before we take a decision on any of them. In addition to what you get in the IEZ duty-free entry of inputs that are used in export oil-based products, you can have SEZs around other concepts, for example, a platinum-based or a solar energy-based SEZ. I would just say that I think that what we do need, the job displacement issue is an important one. In practice, I think if you do go to walk around some of the SEZs as I have, or IEZs as I have, you do see there are a couple of factories and so on. I know they were somewhere else and they moved in there because they liked what was on offer there. That is the case. It does happen. And we do need to make sure that what we do is not just displacement. It must be additional investment. And I think that you can see, I mean, we didn't have First Auto Works before. We didn't have some of the investments in the in some of the auto components linked to the Mercedes-Benz that went there before in East London. There was an aquaculture project that's in East London. There's a jewellery manufacturer. They weren't there before. They weren't in the country before. So I think these are things that reduce the additionality. But we do need to make sure as well that we are careful as we roll these up. I mean, if everywhere in the country is a special economic zone, there's nothing special about anywhere. Everything is just the same. So these things are going to have to be carefully rolled out around a very clear value proposition. And then we are seeking, I think, partnerships, and that's what some of the governance is about. But we're basically saying that any of the spheres of government or entities operating under them can apply to be operators of SEZ. That's the same. And you, the DG said that there was a bit of debate about whether municipalities should be allowed to be part of it, and we said that actually some of them are doing it quite effectively, so they can cut them out automatically. But that's the point there. And then I suppose the transitional arrangement on the IDZ, it says that as far as the main act that establishes the IDZ, that's just rolled over, and the regulations remain in force for another 5 years until a new regulation under the SEZ, that's what it says. So the existing IDZs are basically deemed to be declared SEZs, so they will carry on under it, including if and when, as we move forward, we designate Saldan. The IDZs will become SEZs. But there are a couple of other questions, maybe then to the DG.
Thanks, Minister, and thank you, Chair. There was an issue about Richards Bay. On Richards Bay, I think one of the things that has delayed the progress on the IDZ was the issue between the municipality and the province regarding the transfer of land from the municipality to the IDZ. So that took quite a long time to sort out, and once that was sorted out, is then able the funding that had been set for the IDZ to be made available to the IDZ. I think that was resolved around 2010. But one of the things then that the bill will be trying to put in place is to ensure that we don't have those kind of problems, that we bring together all the stakeholders so that we can faster decision making and coordination between provinces and municipalities. And then the question I think the chair asked about funding for SEZ. I think there has already been some money allocated in the MDF. I think it's close to about 2.5 billion or so that has been allocated towards the SEZ. And so the issue about the fund is just to make sure really that the funding is located in a fund, and it doesn't, because what we plan to raise is that you might require less funding this year because of investment and more funding next year, so we just want to have funds so that we can have money that's identified for a particular period and located somewhere within a fund and made available to SEZ on a need basis. Well, there was an issue around also land, especially in rural areas where there is no ownership. I'm sure maybe that might require that we look at a little more into that issue. But we have experiences with cooperatives at the moment, and where in rural areas land rests in tribal authorities or in communal authorities. What we do require is normally that people get permission, something called the right to occupy from the communal authority. I assume that with the IDZ, it would also involve having some kind of an agreement with the community or with the communal authority regarding land. I'm not sure that we need to do a little bit more work in that area, but I'm sure we will end it along the same way where we get the community to agree on those issues. Maybe I'm not sure that that's something that...
I think that the final one was perhaps a question about provinces and municipalities also being able to provide incentive. I think I think definitely we can look at that, but in practice now, at least what happens is that as part of the application process, the both the municipality and the province contributes, for example, to infrastructure funding, and so national only provides some portion of the funding, but a large part of it comes from the province and from the municipality. I think we can, when we go into the detail, we can see whether that is sufficiently empowering to involve all tiers of government to make a contribution.
Thank you very much, DG. I know we still have one or two comments and questions. Honourable Salah to start with. Honourable Khadebi. Are there any other comments or questions? No. Honourable
Khalasa. I believe Section 1 is not part of the bill. Just information of progress made in this regard. But for the fact that it's part of the presentation, I just want to talk to it a little bit. There's nothing in trying to go deeper than I need to it. One, I realize that it looks like the identified economic activities are related to value adding. That correct me if I'm wrong. And that would be in about 8 areas of economic activity, including agro-processing, ICT. I'm not sure what BGM stands for, but it's one of them.
BGM is Platinum Group Metals.
Platinum Group Metals, thank you very much. Petrochemicals, platinum, renewables, tourism, and logistics. Those are the areas that I see there, but the activities there, if I may be right, would be more focus on value adding. But major little problem here, that is not kind of the major little at the same time. My major problem here is the identified areas do not seem to be putting any amount of focus to the rural development one way or the other. We all aware the South African economic setup is such that we are sitting with the very rural poor and the urban sort of middle class. Maybe if we could look at as we go forward, how could we empower some of the potential rural areas? Like the rural areas, there are rural areas where there is a lot of planning taking place in those areas. Could those areas not be considered also for that reason? The second area, Chair President, is that there is a lot in this presentation that the minister should do. And I am very worried that we should not find ourselves through this bill turning our minister into becoming a managing director of the same LSE there. Because it appears here the board should recommend and the minister should decide. So how many decisions are the board going to be taking? And where will the minister get the time to look through all those things to consider and decide on? Two things may happen. One, decisions may be delayed because of the unavailability of the minister due to other commitments. Or we may find the minister need to concentrate too much on this and neglect other responsibilities. So we will need to look at it a little bit more carefully as to whether we this reflects the minister per se or the office of the minister in a way.
Thank you very much, Honourable Salah. Honourable Khadebe.
Chairperson, I'll compare with my colleague Mabasa, who welcomed this presentation, which is refreshing. Chairperson, I think that this bill addresses the issues which we were faced with when we attended to the Guha IBZ. In particular, when coming to the issue of the management of that affair and the financing thereof. I think there were challenges. I think that part of this bill is addressing those issues which were really pending during that time. So it's really appreciated that when we raise issues with the department, it really they respond in kind. They respond in kind. Yeah. But Chairperson, what I want to go to is the is page 7 and 19, where there was a dispute between the labor and the department, in particular concerning the public-private partnership agreement, which the public-private partnerships which can form an SEZ. The question which I see that the CIO was responding that there's a strong legal or regular framework which is in place. But when you look to page 19, on page 19, it is that the PPP must establish an SEZ as a company. So once it is established as a company, there's a board there. It means that if the private company has got a majority share
in that, it will end up dictating us, because that's how the companies are. The majority shareholder is the one who eventually decides who is going to sing at what time. So, and then when you look at the way this thing is being established, you can see that the public, the government is going to be part. So how are we going to ensure that that situation does not arise? Because really, when you speak about the land, really, coming from the municipalities, coming from the public, and then what wealth, what can be also wealth shepherded, is whether the private partner is a foreign company, whereby the interest can actually be, the decision can be eventually taken somewhere in London. About the issues which are going to affect us. Well, let us say that you close down, scale down the activities there, as a majority holder, then they have to listen to. How are we going to overcome that? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Majer. The Honourable Mabasa, followed by Honourable Mabasa.
Dr. Chairperson, I've been partially covered by Comrade Joe. I do want to say that we really need to find a strategy to ensure that the rural areas benefit from the establishment of the SLN, so that we avoid always creating economic activity in towns and cities to a complete neglect of the rural areas. We are fortunate that there is this infrastructure build program as well, which will assist in shifting economic activity towards the rural areas, and therefore one would want to just emphasize that point, that infrastructure is linked as well to the establishment of the economic activity in the rural areas. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable
Mabasa. Honourable Mabasa. Thank you, Comrade Chair. I just want to speak to one limitation which I would stress that it must be seen as a bigger challenge that we are probably taking now. The issue of availability of land in the context of the communal authority, because we will find that if there is no uniform, if there are no minimum standards of how communal authorities are supposed to support, we are going to find the variances throughout the country where one chief says no, nothing going. And that compounded by the 19 Land Act, the way it's spent, so that we then have two major problems. And this, as DG pointed out, it was DG or it was PDG, that even when it comes to cooperatives, we hear both that sometimes people struggle to acquire land or, you know, on which to operate. So that challenge, we must see if there is no way of resolving it at a higher level. Thanks, Comrade Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Mabasa. Yes, just one or two things, but before I speak, I'd like to ask Honourable Waile. It shows that you're really going to be very actively involved. Thank you. Your comment or question?
Thank you very much. Good morning to everybody. I just want to pose a few questions. I think a number of questions have been touched, especially around the rural biasness, because one of the fundamental issues is that through the local approach of development, there's a tendency of people migrating from rural areas to the cities, and that presents huge problems for the municipalities, because there's no balance urban and rural strategy from the development point of view. I know that one of the examples in the Eastern Cape province, there's been an attempt to identify a collapsing rural, there's something called rejuvenation of the collapsing rural towns. I think it may be one of the options aligning some of the strategies with provincial and the GTA strategies of different municipalities. The last issue relates to the intergovernmental relations. It was absent that a number of people who have been consulted, SACA indeed has been consulted, but at times there's a problem in terms of dissemination of information at times. How do we ensure that as part of the awareness campaign, we reach some of the municipalities, including improving the intergovernmental relations? Because once we talk special economic zones, we have to provide housing, we have to provide hospitals in certain cases, a number of social infrastructure that must be provided in an integrated fashion as far as development is concerned. I just wanted to raise just only those issues. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honourable Maile. Just one point on that, Section 24, is it, that helping establish SEZ as a company. I wonder why we would be so specific, as someone pointed out, was it yourself, Honourable Kadebe, about it being a company, when in fact, as we all know, there is a whole suite of different forms, configurations of PPP that have been tried out throughout the world, developed and developing. And I do think that we do have to be somewhat aware of the company issue, because here you also talk of it will be for a certain time, you know, etc. The minister would stipulate, but I'm not sure how you would stipulate once you are a company SEZ, how this would link up with the company act. You see, so I do think that we may need to review that, one is not looking for a hip response, as it were, but a more considered response, if necessary. But, Minister, over to yourself.
Thanks very much. I mean, let me say on that one, I don't know if the team wants to respond straight away, but I think Honourable McIntosh said something about the role of the committee is to choose that. And the principle is that we want to say that the operator should be a PPP. The form this takes, I think, is something that you can debate and discuss. Clearly the role of the board is also to ensure that what emerges from this is a PPP and not something that starts with a PPP and ends up with something else. So I think the committee can look at that in much more detail if some of the team wants to respond. On that. But that is the principle. The principle is that we want PPP operators. Then I think most of the other questions were about industrial decentralization. And I think that this is a tool of industrial decentralization, not the only one. I would just say that to achieve industrial decentralization is not just about proclaiming part of the country to be this, that, or the other thing and offering incentives. As I was saying earlier on, the operationalization, the management, and the way in which the particular SEZ gains traction is as important as anything else. We're dealing here with a situation where it's not that we can direct investors to go somewhere. They need to be attracted. Sometimes if you have a foreign investor, you would like them, and you see no reason why they can't go and operate in one or other of our rural areas. But sometimes we face a choice of either they'll go to one of the metropolitan areas or they'll go to some other country. So it's quite often like that. So I think that the viability, the ability of these projects to gain some traction is very important. But if you look at them, and look at 10 that are under review, most of us, I would argue, have got some idea of bringing more industrial development to more rural areas within knock-on effect to others. So we think about agro-processing, and several of them are agro-processing. You have an agro-processing operation located not in Gauteng, Cape Town, and Durban, Pine Town, but in other parts of the country, with potential links to a number of other agricultural activities and the potential spur to agricultural production in those areas. You've got, for example, the minerals one, the PGM, platinum group metals. Now, these, I think, the potential activities there are jewelry, exhaust systems or catalytic converters, and they're also then, you know, this really high-tech fuel cell research which is going on in South Africa, particularly around things like small power stations, that kind of stuff, not so much motor vehicles, although that might be on the horizon, but power stations, that kind of stuff. Now, you know, the two potential SEZs of that are located where the platinum mines are, in the more rural or less metropolitan part of the country. So that's where it is. But I think that the ones that are going to be more of a challenge are the ones that cover large geographic areas, because typically what happens in the land ownership, which we didn't ask last time, is an issue. Even in the existing ones we mentioned, the Saldana, some of the land is owned by, that should go into the IEZ, be identified, is owned by the Ports Authority. Some of it is owned by the IEZ, IDC. And we need to, you know, get that land release so we can have a defined geographic area in Saldana that is the IEZ that have been identified. So sometimes you get these kind of issues. But many of the ones, the existing ones, together with the others, you drive outside East London, here it is, here's the fence, this is where it is. You drive into, there's the road, there's the factories, it's all part of it. Where you have something like the Wild Coast, which is covering large geographic areas, where is the SEZ? How does it relate to activities that are in communal land or in other land tenure operations? Those are going to be challenges. Those are going to have to be things that are going to have to be worked on and identified. Then on the, most of the work of the minister is in consultation with the board. Obviously it's not going to be that the minister, whoever's sitting in the seat when this bill comes through, the minister's going to be spending his or her time sitting around and deciding how they're all going to work. There's a board that's going to do the professional technical work, but ultimately at the end of the day, the minister's going to take the decision. I think that's how it mostly works, but I think maybe if there are instances where the demands on look unrealistic, then as you do with that, it's identifying them. But I think mostly it's like that. There's a board, the board gives advice. It goes through a process like we're going through now. These things will go through a feasibility study. The feasibility study will identify a number of the issues, and then in the end of the day, if we declare them, it's going to have to go through the board. That's the way it's going to work. So I think that's how to respond to most of the points that were made. But I don't know if that team, did you?
I think you have responded to most of the issues that are maybe one issue is was on the social infrastructure. I think that one of the reasons why actually it is required that if an application is made, it's made in conjunction with the province and it is made in conjunction or alternatively the municipality. It's taking into account really that, in putting together an SEZ, a private company not necessarily have all of the required institutional or infrastructural, would not be able to put all of it itself without taking into account going into partnership with the municipality or with the province. So this is where the provision is made in the PMP, to make sure that the municipalities are consultants, provinces are consultants, because this will have a major impact on the province and on the requirement from the province of the municipalities.
Just a final thing, I think on the question of the registration as a entity, I think as was indicated, we can discuss in detail in the committee, but currently the arrangement is, for example, Kuga Development Corporation is a wholly owned subsidiary of ECDC, the Eastern Cape Development Corporation. So the key point that I think the purpose in the Act is it must be a registered business entity. So we currently have
that, but I think with regard to the triple P, there is a regulatory unit within National Treasury which oversees and manages all triple P's of government. So I think probably we'll have to just look at whether that is strong enough to ensure that we have proper joint ownership by both the state and the private sector to have the protections. But I think we can get the lawyers to just look at that in more detail as well and then advise the committee.
Thank you very much. Just to note for the record, and apart from those members of DTI, I have already noted we have others here. I'm reading from the bottom up. Janice Jonathan, IDZ, Antoinette IEV, also IDZ, Jim Asani, Sam Binge, Director, CEO, Legal Services, and Javanani Sutoli, Deputy Director, Infrastructure Investment. And again, also Kaya. Can't see if that's a Q or an extra G, but it looks like Nkaka. Is that right? I may not pronounce it right, but there you are, Chief Director. Thank you very much. So you're all welcome, and thank you, Minister, for bringing a full team in this area. This is a very important bill because not only will it create jobs, but its intention is also to attract, as you put it, I think somewhere in the foreign direct investment, which one assumes will have a productive nature, judging from the SEZ identified. This bill will not have a subcommittee. We will deal with it in committee itself, because we've already got enough in subcommittees, all right? And I just want to remind members, this is not an extended tea break. So this time when I say 10 past 11, I really do mean that. I will start. Thank you. And that is with engagement with BHP Burton. Thank you. We would also like to welcome here to the committee Dr. Balani Mkwanazi, the chairman of Billiton, BHP Billiton, Mr. Lucas and Samange Munga, Asset President, Aluminium, and Ms. Lulu Letlape, Vice President, Communications and External Affairs. And of course, someone whom we used to see, who seems to be a consultant for a variety of companies. Certainly, you know, we chair, I think, one or two committees here. But there we are. Yes, we all have to earn our living in different ways. Now, but on a more serious note, we have just about completed an interim measure, our oversight on the impact of administrative prices, the impact of other issues such as transport, such as energy, and a variety of other factors. Cost of ports, for example, in all of this. And so far, I may add, that some of these, especially the ports, have actually done something quite significant. They have significantly lowered the cost, having been here. Through Transnet, of course, and the others. Now, our purpose here with Billiton is three things in a way. It's to look at that aspect, the impact of these things on basically manufacturing, a productive industry, reindustrialization, and beneficiation, value add. But balance the, and, you know, job creation, everything that does. And of course, I can be quoted. I didn't make a statement in the House to this effect because I always believe when someone does something positive, acknowledge it. When they don't, well, then you bring out the whip. But that's why we have a whip. But on a more serious note, we are also very concerned that when the good years are here, in inverted commas, relatively speaking, comparatively, we would expect companies, as a biblical parable, whatever, to have put away some of the monies, etc., or to have utilized it to advance in other areas. And it's the same with industry. We're not here conducting a court case. I'm not part of the appeal process. I must make that clear. We're not. It's a separate arm, in fact, of government. So we want to be taken to the Constitutional Court again. So we have to respect that. But what we are concerned with is what I've said. And we are going to examine and engage you robustly, but first, having given you the opportunity to highlight the challenges, achievements, and what we hope you've either contributed to the country as a whole, other than your shareholders, and what your business plan is for the future in terms of this contribution to the country as a whole and economic growth, which involves jobs and the rest. So members, we're going to hand over to Billiton in this regard. Yes, there is yoga there. I see you're enjoying it for a change, huh? Thanks. Over to Billiton.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Members of Parliament and Senate, just from DI, DG and DDG, it is a special privilege for us to come and discuss this matter with this esteemed committee this morning. Thank you very much, Honourable Chair, for introducing my team already and who else is present this morning. Let me just outline first what, how we understood your invitation and the brief for us here this morning. And before we get into the matter, we'll just briefly introduce the whole company in South Africa and our partnership with government over the years to industrialize. And then the most interesting part of I think for most of you, our negotiated price in agreement with ESCOM and our contribution or the minimal contribution to downstream, it is a beneficiary subject anyway, and our role as a corporate citizen in this country and particularly the communities around which we operate. And maybe we'll talk a bit more about this troubling ESCOM contract with ourselves. The ESCOM is a diversified global company by now. It was formed in 2001 by a merger of a blue chip southern company called Billiton and a similar company, trading company called BHP. And this merger called ESCOM Billiton became even funded the biggest resources company in the world, and it's been widening the gap over the years, now undisputedly like that, and one of the top six, seven bigger companies in the world for full stop. We exist in about 25 countries. We have about 120 operations or so. Why we're diversified is because of the broad range of commodities, spanning petroleum, aluminium, uranium, diamond, specialty products, including potash, iron ore, manganese, metallurgical coal, energy coal, and we, as I said, we exist in about 20, 25 countries. As a diversified company, we have a very simple strategy and objective. Our strategy is to own and operate upstream resources companies diversified in commodity, in geography, and in market. That's why our customers are diversified, our resources diversified, and where we exist is also diversified. In South Africa, we have three main businesses that combine classical mining and manufacturing, and manufacturing is basically beneficiation of mine commodities. We have three businesses here. The first one is manganese.
manganese will exist both in ore and with smelt or beneficiate it. I'll get to that just now. The mines are in Kalahari. There are two mines. There's a Mamapan open cast and a Vessels underground mine. We also have an operation called Metalloid, which is in the south of Johannesburg, in Mercy. This smelting company takes manganese, beneficiates it before exporting it. We beneficiate in excess of 20% of our ore, and I'll challenge you, nobody else does anywhere close to even half of that in South Africa. We operate that smelter, it's the second biggest in the world, and I can assure you the most modern and the most energy efficient. I'll come to what the beneficiary thing is. And the other business is energy called South Africa or called PESA. This is our coal mining business. It is now the fourth biggest coal company in South Africa. We supply about 20% of Eskom's coal that produces electricity. This consists of four collieries and a processing plant. The Akutala, Kipstraat, Wolfenkamp, Wolf, and Middleburg collieries, and then the processing plant. And then we have built in aluminium, South Africa. The president of this business is here with us because we thought the focus was going to be on his business. He'll be joining us in presenting the rest of the presentation. We've got two operations in South Africa, and two smelters in Richards Bay, one called Bayside, started in 1971 and expanded again in 1982, and Hillside in 1996 and expanded in 2003. We also have a flagship smelter in Mozambique as well called Moza. This was launched in 2002. Not many people know this, but we are also holders of a petroleum and oil block of the coast of Cape Town, which we acquired in 2010. We have been doing some three-dimensional seismic studies to ascertain how feasible or not for us to continue with full speed exploration and therefore oil extraction that is in full swing right now. We'll finish that before end of the year. We've invested a lot of money spent on that. I did mention that earlier on this year. As a company, even before we became Billiton, as the South African entity, Billiton always been a household name in South Africa because Billiton is a successor to Genco's General Mining Corporation, also a household mining brand in South Africa for many years, in fact, more than 100 years. As the new South Africa, in the advent of the new South Africa, when we were looking at development and creating jobs and boosting our economy, there was a public partnership program that incentivized companies to invest in order to industrialize or and in order to create jobs. And we were one of those companies which were approached for this program. We were partnered at the beginning with the Industrial Development Corporation and Eskom itself. At that time, Eskom had excess capacity, and in the way to test areas in South Africa that had the potential of contributing positively to the economic development. And then we asked to do the joint investment in Richards Bay, utilizing Eskom's excess power, and this resulted in the Hillside Aluminium Center that was opened in 1996. By then, ANC President and South African President, Mr. Mandela. This worked very well as a public-private partnership, the same partnership was extended to Mozambique, where we did the Mozala Millennium Center, launched in 2002. At the time, Eskom had about 40% excess electricity. Electricity, unlike other energy resources, for example, gas, you cannot store. Once you make it, it must be used or it is wasted. And the cost of manufacturing that electricity remains exactly the same. What actually this was doing was saying, okay, instead of throwing away the power, let's at least sell it to somebody, stimulate job creation, and subsidize at that time, subsidize the other customers, because otherwise fewer customers would pay for the 40% more electricity they're not using. And that's how we got there and created jobs and stimulated economic development in Richard Bay and later in Mozambique. And IBC in AIS did a study on the benefit of the aluminum smelting industry in Richard Bay. The study is still relevant. And like IAS, Econometrics, a few years ago, did the same. We can make this available to the honorable members of this committee offline. However, this is how this complex is looking. Pictorially, Bayside, Hillside, Mozambique. I might add, we tried that the last two are top of the range of aluminum smelters in the world. They use a technology called AP30, and regularly they are ranked number one and two. If Mozambique is number one, or you know, Hillside is number one, Mozambique would be number two, and vice versa. They compete with the other, but they are the most energy efficient and the most high quality smelters in the world. The pricing agreement itself, remember I mentioned that it was a public-private partnership. When these pricing arrangements were made, there was an understanding, an acknowledgement of the fact that they needed huge capital. And this huge capital meant that it needed to take over a lot of years, the financiers involved, that's what is the guarantee that the monies were coming, we're going to repay. In today's terms, those investments are about 50 billion rand. In fact, I think these are the biggest investments post all South Africa and South Africa that will get those days. This pricing agreement follows a very well-known international pricing arrangement called the Revenue Sharing Agreement, pricing agreement. What it says is that in good times we share together, and in the time of Portugal, I like the honorable chair by emphasizing that, because that's exactly how that way. This link the price of electricity to the price of the aluminium we sell it with, and the rand-dollar relationship. When the rand was weak, we paid more because we paid in dollars, Eskom did not suffer. When the aluminium prices were high, we paid more. Because we made more profit, so we're sharing the loot together. Similarly, when aluminium was down, we paid sometimes less, and then over the full year of the agreement, it was anticipated that this would be a fair price for the investment and return on investment. In reality, between 1996 and 2008, when the first of these smelters happened, the aluminium prices were on the high. Most of the time we paid more, and most of the time we were trading more than industrial tariff. And throughout then, we always paid more than the marginal generation cost of Eskom. The problem started when 2008, when there was an economic downturn, and also when the aluminium prices flattened, and Eskom prices started increasing much more than inflation. Over those years, that diagram is saying that the red line, and this is now thousands of rand, over the period from 1998 to 2008, on average, made, in terms of now profit, made more than 2,000 rand a year over those years. Profit they would have not otherwise have had if they had not sold this power. The blue line is the accumulated revenues, any ESCOM made, they would not otherwise made, and say, our calculation verified, that's a verifiable in terms of our calculation, is that that amounted to more than 36,000, I'm sorry, 36 billion rand over those years. This, we have to get that number, we have deducted the additional cost to ESCOM that we have been incurred for supplying us and could know that we have supplied. This is net ESCOM money made over the years. Right. This, of course, over and above these were jobs created in Richards Bay, in our jobs created in Richards Bay. Those smelters, before we get there, those two smelters in Richards Bay, now, they've employed more people, because now they employ about 3,000 full-time employees, 2,800 contractors, and about 33,000 employees to companies that apply to us in that town. We think we are doing our job in Camden Town. Let me give an example. In 2008, when there was a electricity crisis in South Africa, one of the papers which have been published a story, I think responsible in my view, speculating that the smelters might close. The real estate market in which have been relevant. This is the other way of looking at how useful and how important these smelters are to the town. I did mention earlier that in manganese we beneficiate about 20% of it, and the rest, of course, really belongs to this committee because it's equivalent to manufacturing, and we believe in the government strategy of beneficiation. In addition to the beneficiation we did, about 6 months ago, we inaugurated a new beneficiation plant, we call it M14, which cost us a billion rand. This plant, this furnace is state of the art. More than 50% of the electricity here is generated by gas. It generates, in other words, it's co-gen at the same time. It generates its own power and therefore saves 10-15% of ESCOM electricity. There's no other investment that has been done.
May I just interrupt you for a second? I see the students leaving. I understand that you're from the Cape Town Peninsula. Is this a exchange program? In Norway. All right, well there we are. From Norway, the students are here on an exchange program to learn, I'm sure, more about the country, but also the parliamentary system and other matters thereof. So you are very welcome. I see that you've managed to combine business with pleasure from your dress. And so I think that's the way to accommodate a very full program, and we welcome you here today. Thank you very, very much, our Norwegian students, exchange students, plus our members from the Peninsula Technical University. We would also, that's the only reason, and we seldom do this, while members of the public may take precedence over MPs, is when they start standing up to leave. And you see the power of civil society. Now, but we do want to welcome our members of Parliament and their respective spouses from Bangladesh Parliament and the High Commissioner. Thank you so much for visiting us and getting an understanding of how we address some of the challenges we face through bringing forward the public sector, through the Department of Trade and Industry, the DG and the EDG, as well as, of course, the private sector, a major international company, BHP Billiton. Thank you very much. And I am sorry, but you can see now you're definitely on world map if you weren't already, but I saw you were on the world map in a big way. Right.
Well, I'm a very lucky company, naturally, and this does not change. I'm glad all of you said. The rest of the slide is just technical. I think the point is made that more efficient beneficiating plants in South Africa, conservative on electricity. And then let's go back to
to the aluminium story. I think so far I've not mentioned the fact that there's a number of other industries, we call downstream industries, that are underpinned by aluminium production in South Africa. Very well known is Ulamin, in many respects, that in itself can initiate more and export and supply other downstream industries. Companies like electrical cabling companies, rim companies, the cars you drive, also benefit from aluminium production. And they were quite proud that quite a bit of our aluminium do go towards this purpose. Some of the products that are made of aluminium, some of them are imported because it's not cost effective to make them here. Some of them are made here and also imported. I think for the rest of the presentation, I'd like to introduce my colleague, Mr. Lucas Mitsimanga, who I did mention. He is the president of the aluminium business in South Africa, and he is going to tell us about what he's actually done as a good citizen of this country and British of the year. Thank you for me.
Honorable Chair, honorable members, good morning once more. Thank you, Dr. Mkwananzi. I'd like to continue on the story that Dr. Mkwananzi started giving, and again emphasizing the contribution of BHP Billiton into South Africa. Probably let me start by emphasizing the point again from around beneficiation. We see BHP Billiton actually heavily involved in the chain of beneficiation, which is actually starting by coal, digging coal from the ground. But when you dig coal, and then what do you do with coal? So instead of just importing that, you turn that into electricity. And once you have turned it into electricity, like we say, you cannot store electricity. So what do you do with electricity? You need to find means of actually using that electricity to stimulate the economic activity within the country, which is actually in line with actually the drive by the government to actually have downstream industry beneficiation. And that's how this smelters came about. And it does not stop there, which is actually the production of ingots and actually exporting them. BHP Billiton is also heavily involved in actually downstream as well through the support of Ulamin into the downstream industry in order to make those products out of aluminium. So we see it as a chain that is complete coming from coal, ending up with a product that are from aluminium. Dr. Conan also mentioned Ulamin. I would like to also emphasize that the smelters in Richards Bay, they actually supply 75% to 80% aluminium needs for the country. The only 20% that remains is actually special products that are imported. But largely the local aluminium industry is actually supported from the smelters in line with the principles of beneficiation as well as downstream. And then going on in terms of contribution, a bit of figures, just to get into a bit of more detail. BHP Billiton contributes 0.5% or 12 billion of GDP, so we are a player within the country as well, contributing and contributing also in order to ensure that the government is also able to actually exercise its responsibility within the society as well. So in terms of taxes as well, more than 550 million rand per annum in terms of corporate tax. Contribution as well in the form of taxes, personal taxes, to the tune of 1.5 billion rand. And obviously through as paid the EIF, etc. And again, we contribute 4.4 billion positive impact on the current account balance of payments, which we believe is actually of great assistance to the country. And again, coming to the region where we operate in Richards Bay, which is in KZN. And again, as a company, we believe we're playing a role in terms of discharging our responsibility to the needs of that community, which is actually impacting in terms of the contribution to the GDP in the region. And in KZN, that's about 10% contribution. Still along the lines of creating employment, there's actually 7,000 jobs in the area that are actually associated with the smelters. Again, we impact into the livelihood of 33,000 people, both directly as well as indirectly. We are also a key player within the port authorities. We've got a very good working relationship with the port, which we're very appreciative of in terms of that support. And again, we obviously support the municipalities in the area as well. Now, it is also important to note that where we operate, when the smelters came in, there was a lot that was done to ensure that the procurement in terms of services, as well as the supply into the smelter, they're actually from the region. And the smelter was greatly involved in terms of stimulating that those businesses, the contractors that came about. So there's a lot of associated contractors who actually are playing a part in terms of supporting the smelter. We was developed when the smelters came in. And I think if you look at when the smelters came in as well, that part, because of the level of industrialization then, was not yet fully developed. So we are proud of that part, which we actually worked together with the government in terms of stimulating the suppliers from the local area. Again, Honorable Chair, you spoke about our contribution into the community as well. We are involved in community. We take seriously our role that we need to play in terms of the social investment part. Now, this is not only directly linked to profits. So even in periods whereby the smelters are actually stretched, we continue to contribute more than the 1%, which we see as our responsibility. Again, probably at this time, it's quite important, again, to touch a bit in terms of the challenges that we face, which is around the commodity prices. As you would know, the commodity prices are actually stretched in the recent years. We anticipate that in the next few years to come, it is going to be the same. So as a company, we're not immune to that. We are also very much challenged in terms of profitability. But large as it may, we still recognize our role that we need to play in the community. So in the last 5 years, 2008, 2012, our contribution has been to the tune of close to about $300 million. And again, it is actually across different areas, which is around community upliftment, health areas, education areas, and we work in conjunction with the government bodies to actually address these areas. And I'm going to give you a few examples of where we're actually involved in the coming slides. Again, I spoke about employment. There's close to about 3,000 direct and indirect employment, people who do work for the smelter in the area. And approximately 7,000 people who benefit directly or indirectly from employment opportunities at companies that are associated with the smelters. Like I spoke about the development in terms of the contractors around in the area. And again, if you use the dependence of ratio of 4, which obviously we know is very conservative, there are actually over 28,000 people who benefit associated with the 7,000 people that we spoke about. Again, this is part of the work that we're doing from a social responsibility point of view. There's a project that we're very proud of, which is ongoing, a carbon sink project. And the company is spending about close to 6 million rand over the past 5 years. This project is important to address several areas. Besides the environment, which obviously is key to us, and by the way, as a company, we are committed to actually being environmentally responsible. We are committed towards a direction which is actually a green economy direction. So we are participating. In fact, as far back as 2005, the company already had targets in terms of the reduction of the carbon footprint. Now, this project in Ongoye has actually assisted in terms of unemployment, in terms of youth development. And again, what is key as well is also participating in terms of protecting the environment by reforesting so that you don't create the erosion, etc., and you protect the environment. And again, this is a big project that we are actually proud of as well, which is in enterprise development. And Honorable Chair, I've got to mention that we've actually grown in terms of our participation in enterprise development, with developing as a company to actually play an even an important role. So years back, we started actually being involved in terms of developing businesses, providing incubator facilities. So in consultation and also in collaboration with a company called Vesco, there are some companies and actually projects that we actually helped to develop, which is actually providing the support and making sure that they're sustainable. We've also expanded our facilities for these incubators. There's a new building that we're just finishing now, which costs something close to about 20 million rand. And again, this building is a green compliant building, again in line with our commitment on environment. So sometimes in the year we'll also be commissioning this. But again, this actually sets our commitment to actually further improve our contribution into the community, into the society. So we want to see more businesses actually coming through this program and actually helping to actually create the economic activity within the region. And again, we'll probably know, in the last 2 years, we actually got involved in the health area, and BHP Billiton actually took part in the Pediatric Center of Excellence, which is actually at King Edward Hospital. Again, this is actually an example as well where we're playing a role in different areas, and in this area it is health. And again, still continuing along the lines of health, there's a project that we're excited about, which is actually just coming in, where BHP Billiton over 5 years is going to spend more than $200 million, rand, in the field of health, which is actually the mothers before they give birth, and actually the early part of years of the kids when they are being developed, because we see it actually as a very important part in child development. And we do expect to make our impact as well in terms of reducing infant mortality, at least in that age group. Again, these are different examples in terms of our Dreamfield community soccer. Again, playing our role in terms of working with the youth to ensure that we've got youth that is actually kept busy and actually kept responsible in terms of the activities. Again, the examples in terms of schools, we take part as well in terms of disaster relief in different areas. And indeed, we're actually in collaboration with a lot of schools within the regions where we operate to actually partner with them to uplift youth. So those are some of the examples in terms of our impact within the economy. I just want to spend a bit of time again probably going a bit technical and talking about our business. What is our business and where are we at? So I'll take you through our process and also talk about beneficiation. In terms of our process, what you see on the top picture, we actually produce anodes, and anodes are simple compacted cork with pitch, which we back. You'll see the picture just below the top one. Is where we bag these anodes again, which are used downstream processes. Now, these anodes, they actually put with a stem. You can see in that figure you've got two blocks of anodes, then a stem in between. And that block is actually used within the reduction process where we produce aluminium. This is a picture of an electrolytic cell, which is called port in the smelting business. The first picture, which is on the left, is actually a picture of what one cell looks like. And again, if you look at the picture, the second picture on the right, is actually what we call a pot room, where you've got a series of these electrolytic cells. So you are having electricity that is flowing in series within those pots from one to the next one in the production of aluminium. So periodically, every 2 hours, we actually open the tapping door and actually tap this metal, which is in liquid form. We then cast it into products, and those are the products that you see, which is actually the ingot. That ingot weighs about 22 kgs. It's put in a bundle before it's actually transported. And the product that you see on the right-hand side, this is a slab And this product is specifically for the downstream industry in South Africa. This is the product that is absorbed by Ulamin. So this product is specifically manufactured for Bayside. And you'll see it on N2 when it goes to Pietermaritzburg, to Ulamin. Dr. S also spoke about the smelters that we have. If you look at the smelters that we have, Hillside and Mozal, they're actually top of the range smelters. And again, the smelters, we actually chose them deliberately to be the most energy efficient smelters. Given that we are in a challenged environment, these smelters are actually top of the range in terms of being efficient from amount of energy used per ton of aluminium. And again, we also, it's actually very friendly in terms of the environment. The picture that you're seeing there is actually a fume treatment center, which is actually used to capture the gases that are emitted from the process. Okay, and again, we're going to talk about the electricity contracts and the impact on BHP business and aluminium business. Honorable Chair and Honorable Members, I think it is quite also important just to reflect a bit on the history of the smelters. We spoke about, in Richard Bay in particular, we spoke about Bayside, we spoke about Hillside, which is all in Richard Bay. I would like to remind this house as well that Bayside is currently operating at 50% capacity as of 2008, when there was that big crisis in terms of power. So the question arises, which says, well, what is the company doing given the challenge that Eskom faces? And I must point out that we've got a very good relationship with Eskom. We work together through the challenges. And again, our contribution as well was actually the most boring of 50% of production at Bayside in 2008. And that part of production remains the most bold up to this age. We're probably one of the few customers that actually kept that mandatory 10% that actually came about in 2008. So we've kept that. And we've accepted that we've got to operate at 50% capacity at Bayside. Again, in terms of our contribution as well, working closely with Eskom as well, we do work together in terms of managing the grid, especially when the grid is challenged. I think you would have heard also Eskom say that the biggest challenge is actually at peak, which is actually in the evening. So part of the agreement working with Eskom is actually within our contract, we do take off production completely. And in a smelter, it means once you switch off and you don't supply the power, you stop the production in that hour. So depending on how the grid is behaving, so we are actually load shed. It's a weekly process. Again, it is done to actually protect the grid. Now, at that point, we don't produce. And again, we don't get compensation for that. But again, it is our contribution to the grid. So I think if you look at it again, in terms of what are we doing, structurally, we've reduced at Bayside, we're operating at 50%. We take part in the load shed that you see. Again, as a company, we're not just sitting back. Like I said, we've got the top-of-the-range equipment in terms of energy efficiency. But within as well, we're continuously searching in terms of what can we do to actually reduce the energy consumption. And again, I'm proud to say that if you really look at within the family of the smelters that we operate currently, we're actually the top in terms of our energy consumption and energy efficiency. Again, to us, this is an imperative given that we're operating in an environment that is actually power constrained. Again, talking about the challenges that we face, I think the biggest challenge that we face currently is the uncertainty about the NESA process and its impact in the business. As you would appreciate, there's a lot of discussion in terms of the power contract. That obviously does put us in a world of uncertainty in a business that is actually really, really stretched in terms of because of the economic environment, commodity prices that we are sitting at. And the Honourable Chair, this is the presentation of this one. Thank you.
I missed that, Honourable Chair. I think we'll leave there for now, Honourable Chair, and we'll welcome the discussion or answering the question. Will you all be fielding the floor of us fielding the questions and appoint what the couple of the questions are?
Thank you very much. Members, resist that, and please, it's up to you to engage. Comments, questions, Honourable McIntosh, Honourable Hill Lewis, Honourable Mabasa, and Habebe.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Mkwanazi and Mr. Imanga, for your two presentations, a very good presentation. Madam Chair, I think particularly, I think for Honourable Khadev and those of us who are on the subcommittee on the BBEE Amendment Bill, general mining is a good example of empowerment. It was the English-speaking industrialists and capitalists who said the Afrikaners must be brought in. We must do an Afrikaner empowerment deal. And general mining was the product of that deal. And general mining has since done so well. And I want to congratulate Mr. Mkwanazi and his team. I saw a report in the newspaper that Billet and Sheff have far exceeded Xtrata and Anglo-American. And there's Milton Friedman, who I don't think is a favorite economist of some of us, but he did say the only social responsibility of business is profit. But clearly, BHP Billiton has a much wider vision than just that, and we thank you for that. Madam Chair, I just want to say that I am completely relaxed about where Billiton is. I think they have been extremely responsible. I think they helped hugely to develop Richards Bay, which is a place I know well, and I think one can only be thankful. They are very good, have a very good social concern for not only the local area, but in the province and nationally. And I think they're a firm we can be proud of. They're a champion in South African corporate investment. I personally think the whole electricity thing, you go up and you go down, Madam Chair, when you have these huge billion rand investments, it's not turning a profit in a spada shop. It's an enormous planning operation. And I think they have done very well. And frankly, Madam Chair, the reason we had the electricity crisis has got nothing to do with it. It was a government which wouldn't listen to the engineers. And they were being told by engineers in the late 90s and early 2000s, build more power stations. But the government didn't listen. And we had a result. Now, why must Billiton pay that price? I think Billiton is doing a great job, and I think they're entitled to get that electricity, without which we won't have aluminium. As one of my friends had said, aluminium is nothing less nor more than solid electricity. And they need it to make a profit. And Madam Chair, I'm impressed with this resolution. I think we should thank them for coming. And they're doing a great job, and let us keep on at it. Thank you.
Well, there's just one little, point I want to make on that input. In fact, the crisis in electricity occurred long before 1990. It's a great pity that powers that be at that time didn't take action. But of course, the problem continued, and it does not absolve those who came after. But it didn't start in the late 90s, and I must make that clear. Very clear. Thank you. Right, Honourable Hill Lewis.
I'm not quite sure that that's an accurate effect, Madam Chair, but nonetheless, I mean, before we ask questions, to what extent are we allowed to ask questions here? I mean, this is a massive court case that's coming down the track. Can we?
Yes, Honourable Chair,
As I explained earlier, we're not here to deal with the court case. I must make that clear. Nevertheless, the points we make, what is our focus? Our focus really is on beneficiation, mining, and the link between mining and beneficiation, or the, you know, where there shouldn't be any more. That is our focus, and how to ensure that the cost, the input cost here, admin prices and the like, are at a rate that still supports manufacturing and jobs and industrialization. So I don't want to go down the court case, because it's an appeal process. Thank you.
Well, Chair, I think the only thing that I'd like to say is this is a perfect example of why public utilities like Eskom, but others as well, really struggle in terms of long-term planning and decision-making and strategic decision-making in the industries in which they operate. The fact of the matter is that Eskom profited enormously from this deal for 15 years, and it does not seem as though they invested those profits adequately to ensure generation capacity for the times when the deal was not so profitable, which the last 5 years have been. So this is a very, very fascinating case for South Africa and a critical case for the future of electricity regulation, I think. And it's going to be very interesting to watch. But I think it is a case in point. It really is a case in point for the problems with publicly owned and run utilities in electricity generation and reticulation, in the management of ports, etc., etc.
Thank you very much, Honourable Hill Lewis. Honourable Mabasa.
Thank you very much, colleague Chair, and thanks for the input that we have received. Really appreciating. My first question will be on, it's related in a way to slide 5, to ask on that point, 80% of world's high-grade manganese reserve are in South Africa's Kalahari Basin. What percentage of that has already been dug out? Because that would then tell us more or less what percentage remains. And then, to what degree does the National Development Plan assist BHP? And then my last question would be, with regard to, actually, Zwarte Vlak, because with regard to Southern Africa and Africa generally, which other parts is in Africa and Southern Africa is BHP impacting on, especially in the developmental arena? And then the last one is on social responsibility, that when you go into that exercise, do you limit yourself to places where you are operating, or you regard, or you say, as a player in South Africa, we look at what the needs are, where we can make more impact in a developmental and social manner? Thanks, Colleague Chair.
Honourable Khadebe.
Chairperson, first of all, I'll also welcome this presentation. Because, Chair, if you can go to the core of this briefing today, and the invitation of this company was the issue of dealing with the administrative crisis in the industrialization process. So it was clear that the issue of electricity is the issue for the company. Number two, as you said, Chair, when we started that, we engaged the National Cost Authority on the issue of ensuring that the prices, the charges which are charged in the port come down so that our beneficiated products really go out easily, unlike during the apartheid era, where only the cost was subsidized to go out instead of the imports, the odds were subsidized. the all we were shipping out to that plant, the beneficiary products were left with the heavy prices. So what is it, after all this engagement since we started with the industrial polystation plant, how did you see the port charge go? Because I know that a lot of the products go abroad too. The port charge is how does it affect you? What type of arrangement are we having with the National Port Authority in particular around that? Number two, Chairperson, I appreciate this company because I was once fortunate to go and do my practicals at a Bayside Hill Smelter when I was doing physics career at the University of Zululand. It was one of the best, really, it was one of the best run sites ever come. That's why I'm worried today that actually the capacity has been reduced by 50%. Where they started all these things? That's why I'm worried. But what I want to really get at them is that did they put any such on the issue of the social responsibility, number one? Did they put any funds around, aside in particular, to have this historical disadvantage universities that invest to do that in the form of research projects, like for the science students in particular? Because at the end of the day, if we're going to transform this country, we must transform and ensure that the historical disadvantaged people get these high-level skills so that they can be able to run the economy as we move forward. Number two, Chairperson, on the issue of skills development, that's what I'm worrying about again. Chair, those critical numbers which are crashing out there, they are not here. Just like the number of people employed, they are not here. Because what we're also interested is the demographic breakdown of your staff at the company in South Africa. How transformed is this company? Whatever. We went some time back, Chair, we went to Anthometer in Vanaville Park. There was a challenge of the 18 engineers in that company. So on this side, what plan are you having to ensure that you really skill the young and upcoming people so that they can be able to take this company forward as we're moving forward? So what I want to say around that, how many engineers do they produce? How many scientists do they produce as a company? And then around that, demographical spread, how is it? Is it being transformed like that? So what I have for the chief said, we really, as they said that, what I want to confirm again is the issue that when they turn off the electricity chair, then it hampers the production. Because that plant must, the electricity must be run 24 hours a day. They cannot tell each other. So if they are going to interfere with that, we show that we've got a responsibility to also the government to ensure the steady supply of this electricity. Thank you, Chair.
Right. I think we am aware that I've recognised the Honourable Frayling. I want to check. I noticed that the Chairperson of Energy has just walked in and he tried to get here earlier but had another commitment. So if you want to raise the question, you're very welcome to after Honourable Frayling as well. But just to, as you respond to some of these, remember where we're coming from. We're trying to achieve this balance, really, between, if I'm trying to get this balance right with manufacturing and the supply, we can't afford, and we are making this clear, we cannot afford to go backwards on reindustrialization. We have taken that decision. We must move forward, but how do we balance it? And we need your input on this as well, any innovative ideas you may have in this matter. Honourable Frayling, are you wishing to come in then, Chairperson Njikalana, after Honourable Frayling?
Depends on that, Chair. I'm just trying to catch me.
All right. Honourable Frayling.
Yeah, thank you, Chair, and yes, as you rightly said, I come from the Energy Committee, and this issue is obviously a big concern to us, and I am aware of the subject nature of this. So I'll try and speak in kind of general terms so that we don't have to get too much into the specifics, but just to agree with you to a certain extent, Honourable Chair, that we did have a problem with electricity in the 90s, but it was an entirely different problem to what we have now. The problem that we had in the 90s was that because of our planning in the 80s, we had a massive excess capacity, which led to mothballing of coal-fired power stations and then also led to the entry into contracts with BHP Billiton and other producers like that. And as my colleague said, yes, Eskom did make profits in the beginning years and they did certainly benefit from these contracts and they recognized that. I think the big issue, though, is that, and the big kind of unanswered question, and I don't suppose you'll be able to answer it at this point, but was why did we then enter in 2003-2004 period, when we were aware that our capacity was getting constrained, we then entered into a deal with, for the Mosul 1 and the Mosul 2 and the Yieldside extension? I mean, to me, that's a kind of unanswered question, which I think didn't make sense at the time. In fact, it was at a period when Mr. Nkunazi was, in fact, CEO of Nurses. So it's just interesting. I think those need to be seized out, and hopefully the UN financial will start to get to those. But I fully understand the other contracts that we're entered into, and I think EFCOM can't have it both ways. But going forward now, we're in a position where clearly we're in a massively constrained capacity situation with energy, and it's going to cost us a fortune to build new generation capacity. I mean, doing that, we don't want to hit the same problem that we did in the early 90s, massive overcapacity again. But I'm just wondering, to what extent does the deals that you have made with Eskom, does that shield you from any of the kind of increases that the rest of our economy is going to be faced with in terms of electricity prices going up? Are you completely shielded from that? Is it just linked to the dollar price and the aluminium price? Or is it linked to the cost of generating electricity at all? Is there anything in there that, in fact, you would be exposed to in that? And then just the last question, I'm just interested that the deals that you did contract with Eskom around the aluminium price and the exchange rate, has any of these deals been done in any other country in the world with aluminium smelters? Not just your own company, but with other aluminium smelters. I'm just interested to know. Thank you.
Thank you. Honourable Frayling, yes, just for putting a qualification on that one. Are you ready to... Yeah, thank you. Honourable, the Chairperson of Energy, Honourable Angie Kalana.
Yes, thanks very much. Just a short... I'm interested from the PHP as to give the power crunch that the company, specifically and also we are facing in South Africa. What strategies do they have on energy efficiency, particularly you know that an energy color, and that also links to power generation. Are they doing anything in that area, or do they have an intention around coal generation? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Njikulana. Please, we would like you to tackle that. I must say, one thing is clear, we welcome the beneficiation. Nobody is saying that. We don't believe we are getting a sufficient unpack as to what you can do now, given all these constraints, all right? Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, and the other members of all those valid questions. Before I go into the specific questions, my colleagues would fit in and remind me if I've heard all government them correctly, is to go back to what you, Honourable Chair, told us is the overriding objective of this discussion and of the sitting of lately of this Honourable House. It is the issue of the role of electricity in industrialization, in supporting government policy in this regard. I'll start by saying government is correct by making infrastructure, particularly electricity and transport infrastructure, paramount in investment over the next few years. As for electricity, it underpins all industrialization. Any more industrialization in this country will require electricity. And government, not so long ago, also adopted a strategy for beneficiation of minerals. Beneficiation of minerals is necessarily energy intensive, it needs more electricity, you need more electricity. However, there is another metric that is critically important, cost effective electricity, because one of the only ones that do this have always done it, and we normally have to export it. So it's not just Mauritius and the right price to make sure that we are competitive economy, and we also have to balance these things with the issue of environment and the question of carbon tax. Then it brings me to the question of the NDP. Does it have to be a visibility? We believe that the NDP plan is more balanced. It does look at sustainable development. It does look at supporting industrial addition in a responsible way without putting the environment. It does talk into supporting further growth of industries, and we think as part of that industry, we do think that it is broadly supportive. You also asked the question about we have 80% of the whole world's manganese resources in the Kalahari, and yes, that is true. How much of it has been mined, I would say, very little, in comparison to how much we need going forward. Minimum 500 years of manganese is still left in the Kalahari. The best thing about it is that it is the minimum 500 years of manganese left. The best part of it is that it is the best quality manganese, and it is the easiest manganese to get to when you mine. The not so fortunate part of it is that it is very remote from market. You need the rail to take it to the port, and then the ship to take it to market. The result of that is that it then doesn't make us always the most competitive. While we're 80% of manganese, we're less than 20% of the global market share. That tells us that there is still a lot of opportunity there as a country if we balance our issues, facilitation of making sure that we develop this industry for the benefit of all. Let me leave that there for now. You also asked which other parts of Southern Africa we exist. We obviously exist in Mozambique. Until recently, we also exist in Algeria. With a guest business in Algeria. Where until recently in Guinea and Ethiopia, we do explorations in Zambia, in the Congo, and so on. CFI, we limit to just where we are. We prioritize the communities around which we have operations because we take ourselves as citizens of those communities. However, we are also citizens of this country, so we also do sailor projects nationally in South Africa as well as the backyards of who we live. That's why we are better known there. That's why we find lots of other big projects are our biggest projects there. However, national projects do exist. Mr. Sima mentioned the project of early childhood development. That's a national project. We are prioritizing the four provinces we are, but we are very proud of that project. The Dream Field is also a national project, and so on. Mr. Hatere, in our CBI project, we support previous disadvantaged universities, yes, as well as those that cannot. Yes, we do it. Actually, UNISUL, that science is underpinned by us. We support research. We sponsor the university directly, and some someone will add that, but that's really our backyard. The research skills development, we are very big in skills development inside and outside. We even go as far as being the main sponsor of the National Skills Development Conference that takes place annually. So we do play a lot of importance to that. People, in terms of our strategy, are the basis for us. We believe that our talent must come from within as much as possible, not externally. I think both me and Mr. Nisman are examples of that. I remember I met a young engineer in River Bay, and he is now the chief of all of aluminium here. I started in those operations after being a regulator. I am the chairman of this company. We do believe in growth. growing people and do building growing people, particularly in the areas around it, because we want these operations, for people there to believe they own the operations because they provide employment to them. How do you perform in terms of transformation, DDI codes? In terms of the targets that were given for 2012, we actually met them more than a year before. We actually don't work in terms of codes, we work in terms of our own values. The codes happen, by the way, that's why we always are ahead of them, a slight amount. We can, by the way, we can give some of the details of this offline if you like. Mr. Clare, you are right. In 2001-2002, we still had excess capacity, but in my view, as you might remember, then if you were an MP, I came to this parliament as a regulator and did say that we needed to decide to build another power station by 2001 if we were not going to a crisis in 6 or 7 years. And it was not built, and what did happen, I beg to not say anything. I will shield that from the effects of the electricity price increases. The aluminium price won't stay as it is forever, we believe. And you also must remember, this building is not just aluminium, it's manganese, it's coal as well. So we are almost the same as any other carbon, except that we have aluminium as well in our fold. And I don't think people must think that this building is just aluminium in this country. Chair, Mr. Galan, energy efficiency. We do believe a lot. We do believe that the way we behave as human beings has a negative impact on the environment, on the sustainability of the environment. If we're not careful, we're one of the first companies globally to say that. And we do believe in energy efficiency in general. We are sincere to all the energy efficiency calls. We're the founding members of the energy accord signed by companies in South Africa with the Minister of Energy. Before you came, we spoke about our smelters and the most energy shed in the world. We also spoke about our manganese smelting plant, that 15% of energy is from the savings of electricity from the heat gases we make sure. We're also proud that where we are the anchor tenant of the first wind generator in Port Elizabeth, that our building in Johannesburg is supplied by that, by wind, which was the first. So we live in a completely green building. All our offices are green in terms of energy efficiency. We are a good citizen, Mr. Njelala. Nsima, you want to comment on
okay, let me second just add in. I think there's an area again that we're working on. Admittedly, there's more that we can do in terms of the culture of, just change the culture of being energy efficient in our everyday life, which includes at home as well. So it's part of a challenge which as a management team we're beginning to tackle. I mean, if you've got a house, why should the light be on in the bedroom when you're not there? The gears are turning off, the fans, etc., the use of air condition. So as a company, I think that's an area we're starting to work on, we're starting to engage the employees. Like, that's what we're doing now in our bathrooms now, is actually to say, well, you can actually wash your hands with cold water, you don't need actually water from an electric geyser, you can actually do that. Now, those are things that have been taken for granted for quite some time. Like, for instance, in our head office as well, when you go into the bathroom, when there's no one, the light actually switch off. You've got motion detectors, which actually switch on when you come in. So you only use the energy that you, only when you need it. So we do believe, I think, up to the call of ESCOM as well, there's really a very, very big area that we can address as South Africans, which is really generally tackling the area of the culture in terms of energy. We are not yet there, admittedly, but that's a space that we're also getting into. I think in terms of efficiencies, well, I think we spoke about efficiencies, it's actually one of our big KPIs to really say, well, with the electricity that we use, how much lesser can we use in terms of kilowatt hour per ton of aluminium that we produce. So that's really an ongoing process. And I think those figures are also open as well to actually share with you in terms of our KPIs in that area. And again, what are we doing again to assist the current challenges we have? Like I emphasized, we still maintain the 50% cut at Bayside. We've kept it there. And we're still working with our ESCOM in terms of the launches as well. So we periodically take those launches when needed. I think in terms of our footprint in Africa as well, I think one of the areas that we're proud of is certainly Mozambique, where I think like Dr. McCallancy alluded, BHP Billiton actually came in just after the Civil War and actually created that confidence within the country in terms of our investment. And we do believe that actually this has actually resulted in a lot of deals coming into the region as well in Southern Africa.
Right. So we must thank you for the responses we have received. Does not necessarily mean, of course, that we have satisfied us in every direction. But there we are. I see Honourable Hill Lewis has his hand up. You're welcome to raise your hand, Honourable Craven, rather than shake your head.
I'm just interested, as a point of interest, and I know so you wouldn't have been chairman at the time, but perhaps you can just enlighten me. You've got 50% spare capacity at Richards Bay, and yet you established an enormous new facility at Maputo. What informed the decision to build a new facility at Maputo when you've got spare capacity at Richards Bay and the raw materials are in South Africa?
Thank you, Honourable Bailing. And of course, I'll just refer to a question that you didn't respond to that Honourable Khadevi had asked. Honourable Craig.
Yes, Chair. I don't think I've got a full response to the question. The deal that you have with ESCOM at the moment, is this the kind of deal that operates anywhere else in the world in terms of the aluminium industry? That I would be interested in. And then just secondly, the other question was, if the electricity price continues to increase in South Africa, are you shielded in terms of the deals that you have in terms of that? Is your price that you pay only related to the aluminium price and the rand by the exchange rate? I'm just interested to hear that.
Remember the one from the Honourable Khadevi. All right?
Four questions for the lady from Benedict. Could you explain to us the symbolism of your logo?
Thank you. Over to Benedict.
Let me start with Mr. Kelly and I'll come back to you, Mr. Lewis. Yes, if the Canadian snap up in Quebec, the actually I am better off than us. If you look at the cost curve product produced by the consultants, you actually will see like one of the lowest cost smelters in the world. So they are smelters that are even cheaper than us in electricity. When we're not priced at the end of the cost curve, it sounds like they're cheaper than us. In fact, there's always been the fallacy that they will pay the cheapest electricity in the world. It's not really true. They are. And the other question was,
if you are shielded,
our contracts are very specific in terms of relation to the aluminium price and the rent, and I'm not sure what you mean by shielded, but if we mean what governed by the rest of the supply agreement, other customers have, yes. Why did we invest in Mozambique and no more, not increased investment in Richard Bay? I think precisely because you remember I said these were public-private partnerships. These investments were based on incentives provided to us by government and government investments. And this, to us, was proposed as an investment in Mozambique. Ourselves as common IDC, in fact, Industrial Development Corporation still, shareholder in Mozambique. So we're not the initiators of this in general. We just were participants as good citizens to government initiatives.
Well, maybe again in addition to that, probably Dr. McConnell, I think we should also realize that part of the power that is supplied into the Eskom grid, some of it originates actually from Cabrapa, which is in Mozambique. So it's really kind of a Mozambique interest from their side to actually get the development as well. So it's not entirely kind of local originating power. Yeah, not all of it, yeah.
Yes, these port charges.
Just to clarify, Honourable Member, the branding actually represents the variety of our resources, the diversity of resources, and the diversity of the country. If we look at the representation, it shows differences in terms of resource diversification, but also it presents in various countries of the globe.
Let's go back to this thing, maybe give a more clarification about Mozart Smelter is actually supplied more than 100% by Cabrapa Power. That is wheeled through the DC line to South Africa and left Mozambique. So strictly speaking, it's not South Africa, it is Mozambique and South.
I don't want too much of dialogue. I just want to first check. No, I'm not stopping you. I look so blunt. I'm not a baby. I just was looking at something. But was that the port charges. I'd hate to see it going into the archives of the question, please.
We would pay competitive prices in the port. When the port charges, competitive prices. And by the way, Mozambican port charges are different less than you should pay in South Africa. Yeah.
Even under the new dispensation of the new port charges, they've all kicked in, I suppose, but that's a manufactured goods, is it not, DG? Yes, it's still kicking. It hasn't kicked in yet. So I think that could have an impact.
I didn't hear what Dr. Nkunan said. Did he say 50 or 50%?
I said that.
And our final question there, you can see how generous we are in
this committee. Thank you, Jane. I'm not looking like my comment. Now, I'm just interested just from an industrial policy point of view as well. I mean, as Honourable McIntosh kind of rightly termed that amendment, it's essentially solidified electricity. And I'm just interested in terms of the downstream benefits that South Africa gets from that. I mean, is it aluminium simply exported to other countries and imported so that they finish products? Or is there a significant aluminium industry in South Africa that benefits from, for instance, cheaper aluminium which is produced in South Africa? Because obviously we've had problems with the ArcelorMittal deal and the fact that we weren't able to get cheaper steel even though they were getting great subsidies. And I'm just interested as to whether this is worth in that regard as well.
Yes, I think that's very pertinent. Chairperson Njikalama?
Thank you, sir. I didn't pick up any response around co-generation. But my question is, given that you are a resource company of note, can you share with us your beneficiation strategy, particularly in terms of the strong drive by government on reindustrialization? I'm sorry, Chair, if that has been kind of crazy. If you could just in a few minutes, as a former member of this committee, that one area of interest as well, the extent to which the VPD team is contributing to reindustrialization of the country, particularly in the area, arena of beneficiation. Thank you.
I think it is important, yes, over to you,
Jason. Sorry, Chair Jigalan. Maybe I implied the answer, I did not say that directly. We've got three businesses here, aluminium, manganese and coal. As William said, aluminium is nothing but beneficiated electricity, but what he shot at is that the electricity itself is beneficiated very low-grade coal. So eventually aluminium is the ultimate of beneficiating of useless coal because the power station is useless coal. But when you talk about the most energy efficient smelter, because it more or less uses electricity as a commodity, any benefit from, there's no wastage, any savings in wastage, turns into aluminium, not into anything else, better, it's cheaper, it's most efficient to do that. So there's no cogent opportunities in aluminium. In manganese, we beneficiate more than 30% of the manganese we dig. And I did mention at the beginning that we are the only company that benefits so much, I don't even think the next company benefits 10% of that project. To complement and support government strategy in the last 2 years after the adoption of the beneficiary strategy, we've invested R1 billion for more beneficiation, that added a coal-gen plant, which supplies more than 10% of the power to manganese. Coal, we beneficiate to supply in Eskom.
And maybe just to add in specifically to the question of co-generation, I think Mkhwana has spoken about the work done at Manganese, the M14 that we spoke about. So the question arises in the aluminium smelter, what can be done? There's actually a lot of work that was done in that area, and some of the reports we have as well, which was looking and saying, well, is there any heat that is generated? Well, firstly, in terms of the gases are different from manganese, because manganese is CO, which you burn and produce energy and produce electricity. But the ones that we produce, they're not actually that, actually provide that form. So part of the area that we explored, Honorable Chair, was also to say, is there a way we can harness this heat for actually producing electricity? And there's been studies, record of studies of that which we can share. This study did not come up to anything that is actually viable. In fact, across the smelters over the world, aluminium smelters, we don't have such an example. So it proved not to be possible, unfortunately, technically. And I think one of the reasons why it is not possible, I think we did allude to that the way these electrolytic cells are designed, they've been designed to actually insulate and protect as much energy as possible so that you don't lose that energy for the process, so that you use less. So by nature of that design, it does not free up the other, probably the best way of doing it, so it does not free up excess heat that can be economically used to actually produce electricity. So yes, we did actually make studies to that effect, but it didn't come to anything viable technically. And again, sorry, maybe just to add in as well, one of the projects that we tried as well, we've got a dump site which is actually close to the smelter, and we looked at actually harnessing the methane that is actually so created from that dump process. And we worked with a company, I can't remember the name now, to actually generate that. But unfortunately, that project is still running there, but it proved not to be very efficient. It did not really produce the results that we expected. But probably consolation in it as well, because it was around 2005, I think we've seen a few projects that have come up similar, that actually related to this one in Richard Bay, which has been seeking to actually convert the methane gas generated from the west to actually produce electricity. So we've actually explored that area, but unfortunately, I've got to be honest, it did not create the results that we so expected. The other area that I want to touch on is actually the area around the export and on our product. Now, the market in South Africa currently is probably close to about 350 kilotons of aluminium used in the country, and 75 to 80% of that is actually supplied by the smelters directly. There's about 20%, which obviously, I think our vision going forward is to also probably reduce that further. We actually want to reduce that further. But that part, small bit that is actually imported is actually special alloys that we don't produce in the country. But who knows in the future, I mean, with the commitment, we can probably look at that area as well. So after this local, like I did point out that the flare, for instance, is specifically for the local market. And then the rest is what actually gets exported from that.
Thank you very much. What you could do on that beneficiation one, because, I don't think it's only the latest smelter we're interested in. I mean, that's, of course, a very big plus, international, biggest, etc. But I think what's going to help us is if we get a breakdown in writing, started here, and I think the whip, Honorable Khadevi, was making this reference. What can we track as we take this report through? Is this going to be a case study of a benchmark and the way to go, or is this just something, a little bump and blip on the screen that it jumped up? What has been the progress thereof? And we can't really take a gut reaction on this one. We do need facts, so we need you to take us into your confidence. We are very supportive of beneficiation, especially with raw minerals, etc. We really are. So take us into that. Show us, I think, I don't just forget which member raised the issue, obviously, a special price or whatever. Was that you, Honourable Hill Lewis, or who was it? Yeah, Honourable. So I think you do watch what we're doing in the committee at other times. Yes. That issue as well. So that you're able to say, but in order to support industrialization in our country, we're doing X. We really don't have a feel for it yet, and we need to get that feel. So if you could share this in writing to us, and the jobs, of course, and not just those jobs that are, I don't know what kind of radar screen, but the way on. But we're looking at skilled jobs, etc. And maybe we just remind you, we were at Kumba at some point, not that that's all the green light. I mean, there are many challenges there. But one of the things there is that they had a training college, technical training college. They didn't only train for Kumba. I think it was 40% of the people there was other mines, their competitors included. So, I find it strange that this is not being pursued by other industries. And I'm sorry some of the members sitting here are not part of that study visit, but their respective parties were, at the time. It was a very good one, that visit. Take a little leaf out of that book. Go visit them if you like and see what they can offer. But I must say that we really do, as all members of the committee, really are passionately behind the reindustrialization of our country. And now more so than ever, there are so many downward pressures globally, never mind in our own country, on economic growth. And frankly, we cannot afford to go back and go down the hill of deindustrialization. So indeed, although we don't have Eskom present, we have had Eskom here, as you all know. We have had Transnet here, and we've made it clear to them that there is a need for them to find a way of leveraging their finances that don't cost us our manufacturing sector and lead to this. But I don't think it's just Eskom. I think it's all of us coming in there. And you've seen what you can do. You said you were mainly in the rural areas, etc. And I'm sure you did that. And the thing that worries me is if you are so much in the rural areas,
I know Professor Benturok, who's also a member of Parliament, made a reference to Section 24 of the Constitution 3, in which it actually points to a constitutional requirement for social beneficiation and development of the economy. So it's not just a requirement from Parliament, you know, it's constitutionally built in. And we want to see where this is. Schools are important, but so is strategic skilling in this area. Very, very important. Don't only skill for yourself. That's a very selfish approach. Skill for everyone. Members, I know you don't add anything else, but I know that Mr. Chairman, Chairman Mkwanasi, you just basically wanted to say goodbye, I take it. Thanks.
And just to assure the House that we take all those comments to heart and we're completely aligned with them. Next time we'll have more time and if we can invite you to visit us at our plants, maybe we'll, on a one-to-one, on a face-to-face thing, we'll tell you more of what we do in, along those lines and also learn a bit more from you in the near future. Thank you very much. Again, it's been a privilege for us to be here, and on behalf of my team, I'd like to thank you most profusely.
Well, I would like to also thank you, Dr. Kolani Mkwanazi, the chairman, for taking this engagement seriously. Mr. Lucas, D. Manga, I have to follow yourself, Mr. Arnold McIntosh, for all the pronunciation. Yes, it's President Aluminium. And Ms. Lulu Leplace, Vice President of Communication and External Affairs. We thank you for being here with us, but this is going to be ongoing. As the members of the committee, there are two important announcements. One, we are going to produce our report now. It's been there, we've added to it, you know, with the colloquium, and now we need to finalize it. And see what has been proposed has been possibility of looking at a Thursday so we can close it off and maybe again, you know, Friday, but we'll take a decision then we can close it off. So on Tuesday, we will have a better idea, but just to point out the bulletin, for us to close it off, we need this written information. So if you can let us have it by Tuesday, Wednesday at the latest, I know that's Freedom Day, but it gives you the freedom to do that work. Right. Now, where we are with this, I mean, this, yeah. You know, a Labor Day, it will be, you know, we all understand that. It is a commemoration of those who certainly labored and passed and currently. Now, I just want to say one thing here. The IP, the Intellectual Property Laws Amendment Bill, is finally coming back again. We've had it back several times, and the JTM, Joint Tagging Mechanism, has tagged this now finally in writing as a 76. Remember, we were waiting on that. Now we've got the go-ahead, and with the go-ahead, we want to expedite this, and may I add, the National House of Traditional Leaders had always been happy about what we've done. But it was, anyway, you know, we do believe in following due process, even if it does mean going backwards. Yes. So, on that note, we're going to get this back. I do want members here. I don't want them to think they can take a week off. Because, just because it's Workers' Day on Wednesday and it's Constituency Day Monday, please fly down for Tuesday. I won't keep you long, but this is an important piece of legislation. But we will finish off at 1 o'clock. That's if we start on time. All right? 10 o'clock to 1 o'clock. And then, of course, we go back on Thursday. There's no subcommittee that day, so you'll be pleased, Honourable Hill Lewis. In your absence, we thought we'd give you another day to recover. There's Thursday, subcommittee on Triple B, is it? Okay, subcommittee will meet Thursday and Friday. from 8 until 9, half past 9. 8 o'clock until 9, Thursday and Friday. And he did consideration of the first draft, DTS, strategic plan and entities. And the consideration we begin to start, is it? Or will it still be deliberations? We'll do further deliberations on the triple B, double E. And for those journalists who somehow think it's called the B, double E, I think that's an act already, for those of you who thought it was for a bill. The bill we're working on is triple B, double E, or the broad-based black economic empowerment. And I'd like to thank everyone here present, yourself, Mr. DDG Kapuka, for being here today, and also Ms. Naidu, and all the committee members for being here. I may add that soon you'll see gazetted recognition of the status of this committee as a full-time committee. And I hope some of you know what that means. For those who want to congregate at OR on a Friday, it means you're here. You're here. So we will be informing all the others, and I know other parties take it as seriously as the ANC. Thank you very much. You're adjourned. Have a lovely Freedom Day. Thank you.